The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in Radical History for the week of December 29th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some audio is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And other radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in Radical History for December 29th, 1890, Wounded Knee Massacre. At Pine Ridge, South Dakota, 300 mostly unarmed Indians killed when the 7th Cavalry discharges artillery amongst women, children, and fleeing men. 18 soldiers would get the Congressional Medal of Honor for their bravery. In 1974, Ayn Rand, neocon poster child, was asked at West Point to reconcile her view of America with, among other things, the cultural genocide of Native Americans. Her quote was, "Any white person who brought the element of civilization had the right to take over this continent." This week in Radical History for December 30th, workers remembering workers' history. Businessman Frank Stoltenberg, who had become governor of Idaho on the Populist Party, who ticketed then proceeded to call in federal troops to crush the 1899 miner strike, is blown to pieces at a bomb attached to his front gate. On this date in 1936, GM workers' sit-down strike, which began 2 days ago in Cleveland, Ohio, spreads to Flint, Michigan. This was the last sit-down strike in the United States since the Chicago sit-down strike of last week, where workers took over a window manufacturing plant and successfully occupied the building until the demands were met. In 1961, the international edition of the New York Times runs an announcement by Civil Defense Letter Committee regarding fallout shelters.
Condition wrecked. May God have pity on me.
This is Connell Rad. This is not a practice, not a drill.
Take cover! Take cover! Take cover! It's a red alert, condition red. Turn off the gas.
Why?
Why? It's condition red. It isn't practice. It's the bomb. The bomb is coming.
Oh, my God. No.
Turn off the gas anyway. I'm going...
Also on this date in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, indicted by a federal grand jury for releasing Pentagon Papers to the news media. The Pentagon Papers proved once and for all the basis for going to Vietnam was based on a lie perpetrated by the United States government, and the Gulf of Tompkins situation never really occurred. 40 years later, we did not learn our lesson. Hence, we're in Iraq. Also on this date in 1972, Tricky Dick Nixon finally orders the end of bombing. During the 12 days of the Christmas bombing in Vietnam, the U.S. by its own account lost 15 B-52s, 11 fighter bombers, with 93 people killed or missing. Hanoi claims 76 planes are shot down. Nixon, elected on the campaign lie that he had a secret plan to end the war, he had none whatsoever, made a last attempt to get North Vietnam to submit to U.S. hegemony. This final push was 18 days of carpet bombing of homes, hospitals, and civilians in Hanoi and Haiping through Christmas. It is also worth of some note that is the first time in history that some B-52 bomber pilots refused to fly these missions. This week in Radical History for December 31st, 1775, America attacked the city of Quebec is launched during a blinding snowstorm. One of the two American generals is killed. The second is wounded during the opening encounter. The attack fails as the Canadians have killed or wounded half the American troops. Also on a state in 1901, the worst year in the 20th century for lynching in the United States ends with a total of 105 blacks and 25 whites lynched that we know of. Also on a state in 1918, Dr. Marie Ikoy is found guilty of sedition, as were countless others opposing American involvement in one of Europe's bloodiest wars, under the newly amended Espionage Act. This law forbade criticism of the United States government, the Constitution, the military, the flag, navy, or uniform. Some Wisconsin news in 1969, a twin-engine Cessna takes off from the airport outside Madison, Wisconsin, flies 35 miles north, drops three bombs on the Badger Army Munitions Plant. An unidentified person calls the Daily Cardinal and identifies the bombers as members of, quote, the vanguard of the revolution. The Cessna was stolen by Dwight and Carl Armstrong. They had an uncle who died in the plant in 1945 by accidental explosion and were anti-Vietnam War activists, and felt they needed to bring the war home. The three bombs turned out to be nothing more than mason jars filled with gasoline and didn't hit anything. However, they felt it important to do a symbolic gesture. In 1970, Congress repeals the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, and Congress finally fesses up that the United States had lied about the Tonkin Affair.
This is your Radio Root reporter, Hannah George. Today is the beginning of a new year, on some calendars at least, and it seems to be a very revolutionary day. On this day, January 1st in 1804, Haiti gains independence from French rule, becoming the first independent country in the West Indies. In 1959, the Cuban Revolution succeeded in overthrowing Fulgencio Batista, former president of Cuba. In 1960, the Republic of Cameroon achieved independence from France and the UK. In 1981, the Republic of Palau, just east of the Philippines, fought for a self-government, though it was still not completely independent from the United States. In 1984, the Sultanate of Brunei in Southeast Asia became independent of the UK. And in 1994, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation initiated 12 days of armed conflict in the Mexican state of Chiapas. Viva Zapata! Get inspired, folks. Start your own revolution. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also this week in Radical History for January 1st, 1804, Haitian slaves declare independence, and Haiti becomes the first black nation state in the world. The U.S. refuses to recognize Haiti for the next 70 years. Also on January 1st, 1863, kids try to remember this, President Abraham Lincoln frees the slaves. However, you should remember what he said in 1858, quote, I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about any way the social political equality of the white and black races. I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. I am as much as any man in favor of having a superior position assigned to the white race. Abraham Lincoln, 1858. Also on this date in 1932, the year begins with a deep sense of foreboding and fear as the American economy begins grinding to a standstill. National income has declined by 50%. Breadlines now include former shopkeepers, businessmen, middle-class housewives. Charity is overwhelmed. Only one-fourth American unemployed is receiving any kind of help at all. Hubert Hoover starts an advertising campaign by his unemployment relief organization to promote private and local charities to help ease the problems of the economic depression. As public money for relief runs out, many rich Americans oppose increased taxes to help out. More commonly, evade those taxes they are supposed to pay. For example, J.P. Morgan pays no taxes at all this year. In 2008, Goldman Sachs executives get a bailout of $10 billion. Just 3 days ago, Goldman Sachs pays out $10.93 billion to their executives as bonuses. Same plight, different years. Also in the state, 1960, the Man in Black, ex-convict Johnny Cash plays in San Quentin, the first of many concerts he'll perform for prison inmates.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup, those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, A hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy fire, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold. The ark of his testament is stowed. A throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire. And God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb. My head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is burning, and I think my head is glowing, and in a way I'm hoping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway there was no proof, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is glowing, and I think my head is smoking, and in a way I'm hoping to be done with all these looks of disbelief. A life for a life and a truth for a truth, and I've got nothing left to lose, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is smoking, and I think my head is melting, and in a way that's helping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, but I'm afraid I told a lie.
Reporter Navi Santu. On this day, January 2nd, in 1920, the Palmer Raids were at their peak in America. The Palmer Raids were a series of controversial raids by the U.S. Justice and Immigration Departments that lasted from 1918 to 1921. The raids, which were a direct attack on the Communist Party and the radical left in the U.S., involved illegal means of gaining information, illegal searches and seizures, mass arrests, deportation, and torture. J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the Justice Department's Radical Division, actually organized the raids. No wonder he went on to a 48-year career as director of the FBI, the perfect candidate. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, people, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, January 3rd, in 1961, the U.S. officially severed diplomatic relations with Cuba, an event that had been approaching since the Cuban Revolution 2 years earlier. Back in the 1800s, American corporations began to search for new markets and investments abroad. Cuba was one of the countries recognized as a capitalist gold mine and was eventually transformed into one at the expense of Cuba's own economy. In 1959, when Fidel Castro reclaimed full control over the Cuban government and economy, he began to openly speak out against America's exploitation of the country and its people. The U.S. was enraged by this new regime, and the conflict became clear. In order for the revolution to carry out the radical reforms it had been promising since 1953, the business interests of the U.S. had to be disregarded, and a clash was inevitable. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
This has been This Week in Radical History for December 29th. This is my busy time of year, and I've been working so hard that I ran home to throw something together, and I didn't even realize that I'm a week off. Too funny. This is supposed to be This Week in Radical History for December 22nd, and I put a sloppy December 29th program together instead. Oh well, have to pay the bills to keep Glee Glee Studios and lights in action. Yeah, working like a slave, not too revolutionary nor radical, I know, but hey, we're all hypocrites, right? Anyways, got to tuck away for the eve and run back to work in 4 hours. Lots of socks I need to fill with coal for Xmas. I promise you more solid This Week in Radical History is to come in the new year. So please keep tuning in. Stay safe, and as always, remember, I'm forever and passionately yours in the struggle. Mike Cannon.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. In our political discourse these days, we constantly hear that at the base of the conflict in the Middle East is the clash of civilizations. This theory, espoused by Harvard professors Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington in essays and books, claims that at the heart of the conflict is the fundamental difference between Eastern and Western cultures and values, and of course argues for the superiority of Western civilization. At the base of the Islamophobia and anti-Arab speech in the media and at the center of so much of our vitriolic political discourse these days is the emphasis of our cultural differences and that we must dominate those inferior cultures lest they somehow take us over. It is us or them, and this poisonous analysis can only lead to war, and has. It is the clash of civilizations mantra, and it is everywhere in our political discourse these days. Our feature presentation this morning offers a different vision. However, it was given 18 years ago, in 1998, by the late Columbia professor Edward Said, in a lecture at the University of Massachusetts. He challenges what he calls the myth of the clash of civilizations. And if only we had listened to him and sought to emphasize the commonality of our civilizations as well as the differences. Edward Said, perhaps the leading Palestinian intellectual of his time, died in 2003, but his prophetic voice offers special relevance in the current political scene. And that is why it is our feature presentation this morning. Here is Professor Edward Said speaking on the myth of the clash of civilizations.
I'm going to start, in fact, talk throughout about an essay and a book written by Samuel Huntington entitled The Clash of Civilizations. When it first appeared in 1993 in the Journal of Foreign Affairs, it had a question mark after it. And it announced in its first sentence that world politics is entering a new phase. 3 years later, Huntington expanded the essay, some would say bloated it, to the size of a book without a question mark. The new book is entitled, which was published last year, entitled The Clash of Civilization and the Emerging World Order. My premise is that the essay is better than the book. I mean, it got worse the more he added to it. So I'll concentrate most of my attention on the essay, but make some comments about the book as we go along. Now, what Huntington meant when he said that world politics is entering a new phase was that whereas in the recent past, world conflicts had been between ideological camps, grouping the first, second, and third worlds into warring entities, the new style of politics, which he discerned, would entail conflicts between different and presumably clashing civilizations. I quote him, "The great divisions among humankind and the dominating source of conflict will be cultural. The clash of civilizations will dominate global politics." Later, he explains how it is that the principal clash will be between Western and non-Western civilization. But he spends most of his time in the two works discussing the disagreements, potential or actual, between what he calls the West, on the one hand, and on the other, Islamic and Confucian civilizations. In terms of detail, a great deal more attention, hostile attention, is paid to Islam than to any other civilization, including the West. Now, much of the tremendous interest subsequently taken in Huntington's essay, I think, derives from its timing rather than exclusively from what it says. As he himself notes, there have been several intellectual and political attempts since the end of the Cold War to map the emerging world situation, and this includes Francis Fukuyama's thesis on the end of history, which nobody talks about, so the end of Fukuyama, really, and the thesis put about during the latter days of the Bush administration, the theory of the so-called New World Order. But there have been more serious attempts to deal with the coming millennium in works by Paul Kennedy, for example, Eric Hobsbawm, less interesting and more rabid, Connor Cruz O'Brien, Robert Kaplan, and a book that's apparently making the rounds in campuses on Jihad versus McWorld by Benjamin Barber. All of these books have done so, have looked at the coming millennium with considerable attention to the causes of future conflict, which has given them all, I think justly, cause for alarm. The core of Huntington's vision, which is not really original with him, is the idea of an unceasing clash, a concept of conflict which slides somewhat effortlessly into the political space vacated by the unremitting war of ideas and values embodied in the unregretted Cold War, of which, of course, Huntington was a great theorist. I don't think, therefore, it's inaccurate to suggest that what Huntington is providing in his work, especially since it's primarily addressed to influential opinion and policymakers, is, in fact, a recycled version of the Cold War thesis that, that conflicts in today's and tomorrow's world will remain not economic or social in essence, but ideological. And if that is so, then one ideology, the West's, is the still point or the locus around which, for Huntington, all other civilizations turn. In effect, then, the Cold War continues, but this time on many fronts, with many more serious and basic systems of values and ideas, like Islam and Confucianism, struggling for ascendancy and even dominance over the West. Not surprisingly, therefore, Huntington concludes his essay with a brief survey, not only his essay but his book as well, with a survey of what it is that the West might do, or must do, to remain strong and keep its opponents, keep its opponents weak and divided. He says, "The West must exploit differences and conflicts," I'm quoting now, "and conflicts among Confucian and Islamic states to support in other civilizations groups sympathetic to Western values and interests, to strengthen international institutions that reflect and legitimate Western interests and values, and to promote the involvement of non-Western states in those institutions." That's a very interventionist and quite aggressive attitude towards other civilizations to get them to be more Western. So strong and insistent is Huntington's notion that other civilizations necessarily clash with the West, and so relentlessly aggressive and chauvinistic is his prescription for what the West must do to continue winning, so that the reader is forced to conclude that he's really most interested in continuing and expanding the Cold War by other means rather than advancing ideas that might help us to understand the current world scene or ideas that would try to reconcile between cultures. Not only will conflict continue, but he says, the conflict between civilizations will be the latest phase in the evolution of conflict in the modern world. It's as a very brief and rather crudely articulated manual in the art of maintaining a wartime status in the minds of Americans and others that Huntington's work has to be now understood. I'd go so far as saying that it argues from the standpoint of Pentagon planners and defense industry executives who may have temporarily lost their occupations after the end of the Cold War but have now discovered a new vocation for themselves. But perhaps because Huntington is more interested in policy prescriptions than he is either in history or in the careful analysis of cultures, Huntington, in my opinion, is quite misleading in what he says and how he puts things. A great deal of his argument, first of all, depends on second- and third-hand opinion that scants the enormous advances in our concrete understanding and theoretical understanding of how cultures work, how they change, and how they can best be grasped or apprehended. A brief look at the people and opinions he quotes suggests that journalism and popular demagoguery are his main sources rather than serious scholarship or theory. When you draw on tendentious publicists and scholars, you already prejudice the argument in favor of conflict and polemic rather than in favor of true understanding and the kind of cooperation between peoples that our planet needs. Huntington's authorities are not the cultures themselves, but a small handful of authorities picked by him because, in fact, they emphasize the latent bellicosity in one or another statement by one or another so-called spokesperson for about that culture. The giveaway for me is the title of his book and his essay, The Clash of Civilizations, which is not his phrase, but Bernard Lewis's. On the last page of Lewis's essay, entitled The Roots of Muslim Rage, which appeared in the September 1990 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Lewis speaks about the current problem with the Islamic world. I quote, "This is incredible stuff. It should by now be clear," Lewis says, "that we are facing a mood and a movement in Islam far transcending the level of issues and policies and the governments that pursue them. This is no less than a clash of civilizations. The perhaps irrational, but surely historic receptions of an ancient rival against our, whenever you hear the word our, you want to head for the exit, against our Judeo-Christian heritage, our secular present, and the worldwide expansion of both. It is crucially important that we, on our side, should not be provoked into an equally historic but also equally irrational reaction against that rival. In other words, we shouldn't be as crazy as they are. And, of course, Lewis is very much listened to at the Council of Foreign Relations, the New York Review of Books, and so on and so forth. But few people today with any sense would want to volunteer such sweeping characterizations as the ones advanced by Lewis about a billion Muslims scattered through five continents, dozens of differing languages and traditions and histories. Of them all, Lewis says that they are all enraged at Western modernity, as if a billion people were really only one person, and Western civilization was no more complicated a matter than a simple declarative sentence. But what I do want to stress is, first of all, how Huntington has picked up from Lewis in a classical kind of Orientalist gesture the notion that that civilizations are monolithic and homogeneous. And second, how, again from Lewis, he assumes the unchanging character of the duality between us and them. In other words, I think it's absolutely imperative to stress that, like Lewis, Huntington doesn't write neutral, descriptive, and objective prose, but is himself a polemicist whose rhetoric not only depends heavily on prior arguments about a war of all against all, but in effect perpetuates them. Far from being an arbiter between civilizations, which is what he suggests he might be doing, Huntington is a partisan, an advocate of one civilization over all the others. Like Lewis, Huntington defines Islamic civilization reductively, as if what most matters about it is its supposed anti-Westernism. I mean, it doesn't matter to him that Muslims have other things to do than to think about the West with hatred. But you get the impression that that's all they're thinking about, is how to destroy the West, bomb it, and, you know, destroy the whole world, really. For his part, Lewis tries to give a set of reasons for his definition that Islam has never modernized, that it never separated between church and state, that it has been incapable of understanding other civilization, all of them, you know, complete untruths. I mean, of course, the Arabs, Muslims have traveled well before the Europeans in the East, in Africa, and in Europe, and were great discoverers of other civilization well before Marco Polo and Columbus. But Huntington doesn't bother with any of this. For him, Islam, Confucianism, and the other five or six civilizations, Hindu, Japanese, Slavic, Orthodox, Latin American, and African, that still exist, are separate from each other, and consequently potentially in a conflict which he wants to manage, not resolve. He writes, therefore, as a crisis manager, not as a student of cultures and civilizations, nor as a reconciler between them. At the core, and this is what has made his work strike so responsive a chord among post-Cold War policymakers, is this sense that you saw in crisis managing prose during the Vietnam War, this sense of cutting through a lot of unnecessary details. You go through masses of scholarship and huge amounts of experience, and you boil all of it down to a couple of catchy, easy to quote and remember ideas, which are then passed off as pragmatic, hard-headed, practical, sensible, clear. But is this, and now I come to the more serious part of what I have to say, is this the best way to understand the world we live in? Is it wise to produce a simplified map of the world and then hand it to generals and civilian lawmakers as a prescription for first comprehending and then acting in the world? Doesn't this, in effect, prolong and deepen conflict? What does it do to minimize civilizational conflict? Do we want the clash of civilizations? Doesn't it mobilize nationalist passions and therefore nationalist murderousness? Shouldn't we be asking the question, why is one doing this sort of thing? To understand or to act? To mitigate or to aggravate the likelihood of conflict? I'd want to begin to survey the world situation by commenting on how prevalent it has become for people to speak now in the name of large and, in my opinion, undesirably vague and manipulable abstractions like the West or Japanese culture or Slavic culture or Islam or Confucianism, labels that collapse particular religions, races, and ethnicities into ideologies that are considerably more unpleasant and provocative than Gobineau and Renan did 150 years ago. Let me give a couple of examples to illustrate what I mean. The language of group identity makes a particularly strident appearance from the middle to the end of the 19th century as the culmination of decades of international competition between the great European and American powers for territories in Africa and Asia. In the battle for the empty spaces of Africa, the so-called Dark Continent, France and Britain, Germany, Belgium, Portugal, resort not only to force, but to a whole slew of theories and rhetorics for justifying their plunder. Perhaps the most famous of such devices is the French notion of the civilizing mission, la mission civilisatrice, a notion underlying which is the idea that some races and cultures have a higher aim in life than others. This gives the more powerful, the more developed, the more civilized, the higher, the right to colonize others, not in the name of brute force or plunder, both of which are standard components of the exercise, but in the name of a noble ideal. Conrad's most famous story, The Heart of Darkness, is an ironic, even terrifying enactment of this thesis that, as the narrator puts it, the conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea, an idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, and an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can bow down before and sacrifice to. In response to this sort of logic, two things occur. One is that competing imperial powers invent their own theory of cultural destiny in order to justify their actions abroad. Britain had such a theory, Germany had one, Belgium had one, and of course in the concept of manifest destiny, the United States had one too. These redeeming ideas dignify the practice of competition and clash, whose real purpose, as Conrad quite accurately saw, was self-aggrandizement, power, conquest, treasure, and unrestrained self-pride. I'd go so far as to say that what we today call the politics or the rhetoric of identity, by which a member of one ethnic or religious or national or cultural group puts that group at the center of the world, derives from that period of imperial competition at the end of the last century. And this, in turn, provokes the concept of worlds at war that quite obviously is at the heart of Huntington's article. In the related fields of political economy, geography, anthropology, and historiography, the theory that each world is self-enclosed, has its own boundaries and special territory, is applied to the world map, to the structure of civilizations, to the notion that each race has a special destiny, a psychology, and an ethos. Renan said, for example, that the Chinese race, its destiny is to serve. They are docile people and they must serve. The black race must be the laborers of mankind because they're strong in physique and can work hard. That kind of... All of these ideas, almost without exception, are based not on the harmony but on the clash or conflict between worlds. The second thing that happens is that the lesser peoples, the objects of the imperial gaze, so to speak, respond by resisting their forcible manipulation and settlement. We now know that active resistance to the white man began the moment he set foot in places like Algeria, East Africa, India, and elsewhere. Later, primary resistance was succeeded by secondary resistance, the organization of political and cultural movements determined to achieve independence and liberation from imperial control. At precisely the moment in the 19th century that among the European and American powers a rhetoric of cultural self-justification begins to be widespread, a responding rhetoric among the colonized people develops, one that speaks in terms of African or Asian or Arab or Muslim unity, independence, self-determination. In India, for example, the Congress Party was organized in 1880, and by the turn of the century had convinced the Indian elite that only by supporting Indian languages, industry and commerce could political freedom come. These are ours and ours alone, runs the argument, and only by supporting our world against theirs, note the us versus them construction, can we finally stand on our own. One finds a similar logic at work during the Meiji period in modern Japan. Something like this rhetoric of belonging is also lodged at the heart of each independence movement's nationalism. And it achieved the result shortly after World War II, not only of dismantling over a period of about 20 years the classical empires, but of winning independence for dozens of countries thereafter. India, Indonesia, most of the Arab countries, Indochina, Algeria, Kenya, etc. All these emerged onto the world scene, sometimes peacefully, sometimes as the effect of internal developments, as in the Japanese instance, or of ugly colonial wars and wars of national liberation. In both the colonial and post-colonial context, therefore, rhetorics of general cultural or civilizational specificity went in two potential directions. One, a utopian line that insisted on an overall pattern of integration and harmony between all peoples. The other, a line that suggested as to how all cultures were so specific and jealous as to reject and war against all the others. Among instances of the utopian are the language and institutions of the United Nations, founded in the aftermath of World War II, and the subsequent development out of that of various attempts at world government, predicated on coexistence, voluntary limitations of sovereignty, the integration of peoples and cultures harmoniously. Among the second are the theory and practice of the Cold War, and more recently the idea of the clash of civilizations, which appears to be a necessity for a world of so many parts, and indeed even a certainty. According to this, cultures and civilizations are basically separated from each other. That is to say, the core of Islam is to be separated from everything else. The core of the West is to be separated from all the others. I don't want to be invidious here. In the Islamic world, there has been a resurgence of rhetoric and movements stressing the innate opposition between Islam and the West. Just as in Africa, Europe, Asia, and elsewhere, movements have appeared that stress the need for excluding or exterminating, as in Bosnia, others as undesirable. White apartheid in South Africa was such a movement, as is the Zionist idea that Palestine should be for the Jews only and that Palestinians as non-Jews should have a lesser place. Afrocentricity, Islamocentricity are movements that also stress the independence and separateness of cultures. Within each civilizational camp, we will notice there are official representatives of that culture who make themselves into its mouthpiece, who assign themselves the role of articulating our, or for that matter, their essence. This always requires compression, reduction, exaggeration. So on the first and most immediate level, then, statements about what our culture is, civilization is, or ought to be, necessarily involves a contest over the definition. That's why I think it's more accurate to say that the period we're living in is not the clash of civilization, but the clash of definitions. Anyone who has the slightest understanding of how cultures really work knows that defining the culture, saying what it is for members of that culture, is always a major, and even in undemocratic societies, an ongoing contest. There are canonical authorities to be selected, regularly revised, debated, selected, dismissed. There are ideas of good and evil, belonging or not belonging, hierarchies of values to be specified, discussed, rediscussed. Each culture, moreover, defines its enemies, what stands beyond it and threatens it, an other to be despised and fought against. But cultures are not the same. There is an official culture, the culture of priests, academics, and the state. It provides definitions of patriotism, loyalty, boundaries, and what I've called belonging. It is this official culture that speaks in the name of the whole. But it's also true, and this is completely missing from the clash of civilization argument as we hear it in Huntington. In addition to the mainstream or official culture, there are dissenting or alternatives, unorthodox, heterodox strands that contain many anti-authoritarian themes in them that are in competition with the official culture. These can be called the counterculture, an ensemble of practices associated with various kinds of outsiders, the poor, immigrants, artistic bohemians, workers, rebels, artists. From the counterculture comes the critique of authority and attacks on what is official and orthodox. No culture is understandable without some sense of this ever-present source of creative provocation from the unofficial to the official. To disregard the sense of restlessness in the West, in Islam, in Confucianism, within each culture, and to assume that there's complete homogeneity between culture and identity is to miss what is vital and fertile in culture. A couple of years ago, Arthur Schlesinger wrote a book called The Disuniting of America, which is a kind of cri de coeur about the way in which American history, which for him is the history of Bancroft and Adams and so on, is dissolving into something quite different. And he says that new groups in American society want the writing of history to reflect not only an America that was conceived of and ruled by patricians and landowners, but an America in which slaves, servants, laborers, and poor immigrants played an important but as yet unacknowledged role. The narratives of such people, silenced by the great discourses whose source was Washington, the investment banks of New York, the universities of New England, and the great industrial fortunes of the Middle and Far West, have come to disrupt the slow progress and unruffled serenity of the official story. They ask questions, interject the experience of social unfortunates, and make the claims of lesser peoples, of women, Asian and African Americans, and various other minorities, sexual as well as ethnic. There's a similar debate inside the Islamic world today, which in the often hysterical outcry about the threat of Islam, Islamic fundamentalism, and terrorism that one encounters so often in the media, is often lost sight of completely. Like any other major world culture, Islam contains within itself an astonishing variety of currents and countercurrents. I would say that it is this extremely widespread attitude of questioning and skepticism towards age-old authority that characterizes the post-war world in both East and West. And it's that that Huntington cannot handle and therefore resorts to the business of the clash of cultures and the clash of civilizations. Two theorists of that sort, civilization identity is a stable and undisturbed thing, like a room full of furniture at the back of your house. This is extremely far from the truth, not just in the Islamic world, but throughout the entire surface of the globe. To emphasize the differences between cultures is completely to ignore the literally unending debate about defining the culture or civilization within those civilizations, including Western ones. These debates completely undermine any idea of a fixed identity, and hence of relationships between identities, what Huntington considers to be a sort of ontological fact of political existence, to wit, the clash of civilizations. Too much attention paid to managing and clarifying the clash of cultures obliterates something else: the fact of a great, often silent exchange and dialogue between them. What culture today, whether Japanese, Arab, European, Korean, Chinese, Indian, has not had long, intimate, and extraordinarily rich contacts with other cultures? There is no exception to this exchange at all. Much the same is true of literature, where readers, for example, of García Márquez, Naguib Mahfouz, Kenzaburo Oe, exist far beyond the national or cultural boundaries imposed by language and nation. In my own field of comparative literature, there's a commitment to the relationships between literatures as to their reconciliation and harmony despite the existence of powerful ideological and national barriers between them. And this sort of cooperative, collective enterprise is what one misses in the proclaimers of an undying clash between cultures. The lifelong dedication that has existed in all modern and ancient societies among scholars, artists, musicians, visionaries, and prophets to try to come to terms with the other, with that other society or culture that seems so foreign and so distant. It seems to me that unless we emphasize and maximize a spirit of cooperation and humanistic exchange, and here I don't speak simply of uninformed delight or amateurish enthusiasm for the exotic, but rather profound existential commitment and labor on behalf of the other, unless we do that, we are going to end up superficially and stridently banging the drum for our culture in opposition to all the others. And we know also in another very important study of the way cultures work, the book co-authored or co-edited by Terence Ranger and Eric Hobsbawm, that even tradition can be invented. I mean, the idea of a culture and a civilization being something that's stable and fixed is completely disproved by this notion of how traditions can be invented, manufactured for the occasion. So the traditions are really not the wonderfully stable things that we are, but rather abstractions that can quite easily be created and destroyed, manipulated, and so on. As I've argued in several of my own works, in today's Europe and the United States, what is described as Islam, for instance, because this is where the burden, I think, of Clash of Civilizations thesis goes. What is described as Islam belongs to the discourse of Orientalism, a construction fabricated to whip up feelings of hostility and antipathy against a part of the world that happens to be of strategic importance for its oil, its threatening adjacence to Christianity, its formidable history of competition with the West. Yet this is a very different thing than what, to Muslims who live within its domain, Islam really is. There's a world of difference between Islam in Indonesia and Islam in Egypt. By the same token, the volatility of today's struggle over the meaning and definition of Islam is evident in Egypt, where the secular powers of society are in conflict with various Islamic protest movements and reformers over the nature of Islam. And in such circumstances, the easiest and the least accurate thing is to say, that is the world of Islam, and see how it is all terrorists and fundamentalists, and see also how different, how irrational they are compared to us. But the truly weakest part, and I conclude here, or the weakest part of the clash of cultures and civilizations thesis is the rigid separation assumed between them, despite the overwhelming evidence that today's world is in fact a world of mixtures, of migrations, and of crossings over, of boundaries traversed. One of the major crises affecting countries like France, Britain, and the U.S. has been brought about by the realization, now dawning everywhere, that no culture or society is purely one thing. Sizable minorities, North Africans in France, the African, Caribbean, and Indian populations in Britain, Asian and African elements in this country, dispute the idea that civilization that prided themselves on being homogeneous can continue to do so. There are no insulated cultures or civilizations. Any attempt made to separate them into the watertight compartments alleged by Huntington and his ilk does damage to their variety, their diversity, their sheer complexity of elements, their radical hybridity. The more insistent we are on the separation of cultures, the more inaccurate we are about ourselves and about others. The notion of an exclusionary civilization is, to my way of thinking, an impossible one. The real question, then, is whether in the end we want to work for civilizations that are separate, or whether we should be taking the more integrative, the perhaps more difficult path, which is to try to see them as making one vast whole whose exact contours are impossible for any person to grasp, but whose certain existence we can intuit and feel and study. In view of the depressing actualities around us, the presence of many intercultural, inter-ethnic conflicts, it does seem to me ostrich-like to suggest that we in Europe and the U.S. should maintain our civilization, which Huntington calls the West, by holding everyone and all the others at bay, increasing the rifts between peoples in order to prolong our dominance. That is, in effect, what he argues, and one can quite easily understand why it is that his essay was published in Foreign Affairs and why so many policymakers have drifted toward it as allowing the U.S. to extend the mindset of the Cold War into a different time and for a new audience. Much more productive and useful is a new global mentality or consciousness that sees the dangers we face from the standpoint of the whole human race. These dangers include the pauperization of most of the globe's population, the emergence of virulent local, national, ethnic, and religious sentiment, as in Bosnia, Rwanda, Lebanon, Chechnya, and elsewhere, the decline of literacy and onset of a new illiteracy based on electronic modes of communication, television, and the new information global superhighway, the fragmentation and threatened disappearance of the grand narratives of emancipation and enlightenment. Our most precious asset in the face of such a dire transformation of history is the emergence, not of a sense of class, but a sense of community, understanding, sympathy, and hope, which is the direct opposite of what Huntington provokes. If I may quote some lines by the great Martinican poet, Aimé Césaire, that I used in my book on culture and imperialism, and I never tire of quoting these lines, and he speaks here of man, l'homme in French. But the work of man is only just beginning, and it remains to conquer all the violence entrenched in the recesses of our passion. And no race possesses the monopoly of beauty, of intelligence, of force, and there is a place for all at the rendezvous of victory. In what they imply, these sentiments prepare the way for a dissolution of cultural barriers as a kind of blockage between cultures, as well as of the pride that prevents the kind of benign globalism already to be found, for instance, in the environmental movement, in scientific cooperation, in the women's movement, in the universal concern for human rights, in concepts of global thought that stress community and sharing over racial, gender, or class dominance. It would seem to me, therefore, that efforts to return the community of civilizations to a primitive stage of narcissistic struggle needs to be understood not as descriptions about how, in fact, civilizations behave, but rather as incitements to wasteful conflict and unedifying chauvinism. And that seems to be exactly what we don't need. Thank you.
You have been listening to Columbia University Professor Edward Said speaking in 1998 on the myth of the clash of civilizations. The lecture was followed by a question and answer period, and I want to include one of the answers Professor Said gave, even though it is obviously dated. In listening to this answer, remember that it is given only 4 years after the Oslo agreements were signed, Arafat was still alive, and the wall had not even been started. Yet there is a relevance to this question that I felt needed to be included in Said's presentation. The question was, how do these ideas of coexistence relate to the question of Palestine? Here is Edward Said's answer.
No, I think that the situation of the Palestinians is at this moment really quite, well, it's verging on the catastrophic, I'd say. I mean, it's not a happy moment. Not only is there really a quite crazy, in my opinion, well, egregious is the word I sometimes use for Netanyahu, but I mean, he's a bloody, there's something quite bloodthirsty about it. And this is the head of the, as Mr. Arafat calls them, our peace partners, on the one hand. And on the other, you have the United States pretty much backing Israel. I mean, there are a few bleats here and there from Albright and a couple of others saying, well, please, time out on the settlements. I mean, the suggestion being, if you count to 10, and during the count of 10, you don't build any settlements, you're somehow being a nice guy. And then after 10, you can build all the settlements you want, which is the theory, I think. And supplying Israel with billions of dollars a year. They say 3 billion. There was a letter in the Times yesterday exactly about that. Say, well, why don't we say something to them about it? We keep on punishing the Palestinians. We withhold $100 million of aid. And here, for the Palestinians, because they're not fighting terrorism enough, which means pretty much lock everybody up. So why don't we withhold some of the aid to Israel? That was the question. I think it's a very good question. It's never asked. And then, I mean, it's a catalog of woes. And then, you know, we're at a moment in our history, as Palestinians, that we are led by, I don't know, words fail me, I don't know what we're led by, but not a very bright leadership. You know, going from one mistake after another without and there's a kind of natural thing that occurs amongst most people, that in times of trouble you don't want to change horses in midstream. I mean, and there's a leader, and we're beset on all sides. We can't move. The refugees have no passports. They're unable to work. They're unable to travel. You know, there's 7 million Palestinians in the world today, more or less, facing the same problems, some obviously worse than others. And the people on the West Bank and Gaza have lost, you know, 50% of their income over the last 4 years since the peace process began. And unemployment is up to anywhere between, you know, 30 and 60%. And houses are constantly being destroyed, and property is taken from Palestinians, and new settlements are being built in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is being Judaized. So in all of this, it's very difficult to say that there's much brightness on the horizon. I think it's a particularly bad period, which I'm afraid will get worse, because the leadership is very shaky. Arafat has very little popularity now, for obvious reasons. I mean, he hasn't delivered anything except problems, and he keeps rounding people up, as the Israelis tell him to do. And his men in Washington keep on conceding more to the Israelis, agreeing to more humiliating terms. And I think the main problem, and I think this will probably help a great deal in the near future, will be the clarification of what it is that we're all about. I mean, you know, for years we used to say that we want to liberate Palestine, and then we say we want to liberate a part of Palestine, then we want sovereignty on that, then we accept autonomy on that. We don't even get that. So the horizon keeps shrinking, and people don't know what the whole struggle is all about. And until that is made clear, unless there's some kind of consensus, which is bound to arise at some point, I think our situation will get worse. And finally, you know, it's been my, Bell shares the same, I think, view. It's been our view that, you know, that the United States plays an extremely important role. And I think the view of most people, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, citizens like ourselves, is that the situation in the Middle East, especially with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, is simply unacceptable. I mean, this is, you know, the most extraordinary kind of flouting of the rules of international and even national behavior. Collective punishment is the order of the day. People are killed all the time. And, you know, the idea is that Israel can do this and we can continue to pay for it. So what I've been surprised by is the absence of a movement in this country of people who are willing to take this quite important issue. And it's a movement, I think, that a lot of Jews have to be involved in. I don't think it's I know it's Rosh Hashanah, so I don't think... it's not something that you can turn your head away from, because this is done in the name of the Jewish people. And I think it's a quite important political and historical struggle. And at the bottom is a question of fairness and justice. Not of the United States, but of the, you know, of the future of these two peoples who have to in some way share Palestine. But I think the role of the United States and the United States citizenry is absolutely central. Raise consciousness and asking questions and not allowing these things to happen in the name of the West and the great and the good and the beautiful without demur. And I think, if I might just say one more thing to my Jewish friends, that I think the crisis is a crisis of conscience. That is to say, until there's a widespread recognition and acknowledgement of what Israel cost the Palestinians, and that the present identity of Israel today is fundamentally intertwined with the tragedy of the Palestinians, one caused by the other, there will never be peace, because you can't continue to sweep away the fact that Israel was constructed on the ruins of another society and by the mass dispossession of another people who remain unacknowledged as just sort of obscure natives in the background, back to the desert, let them go to one of the other Arab countries. That's been the position. And we bear no... The Oslo Accords say specifically that Israel bears no responsibility for the costs of the occupation. This after 20 years, 26 years of military occupation, no responsibility. As an Israeli journalist said, he said, we took over the country in 1948 from the British. The British left us the port of Haifa, a road system, an electrical system, a large number of municipal buildings, and lots of prisons. And we could build Israel. Without that, there would be no state today. If we had taken Palestine in 1948 the way we left Gaza for the Palestinians, there would be no Israel. We destroyed the economy. We deported most of the capable people. We forced the people to live in hovels and refugee camps over a period. I mean, if anybody's been to Gaza, it's one of the most criminal places on earth because of Israeli policy of occupation. And they bear no responsibility for it. I mean, that's simply unacceptable. Even for the Jewish people who have suffered so much, it's unacceptable. You cannot continue to victimize somebody else just because you yourself were a victim once. There has to be a limit.
That was Professor Edward Said speaking at the University of Massachusetts on the myth of the clash of civilizations in 1998.
This is Radio Freedom.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. German police and intelligence services, this week's winner of allowing a top terror suspect to kill innocent people again. If you believe what the German police and security services are saying, how many of us have to die before these securecrats are sacked? The Russian ambassador to Turkey also assassinated with this Christmas market attack in Berlin as well. But mounting questions about both events, which throw doubt on the competence of those who are supposed to be looking after us. Same with the 7/7 London bombings, wasn't it? Egyptian police also arrest a film crew faking scenes in Syria, pretending to be in Syria anyway, while the real Aleppo, scores of Western intelligence officers paid with our taxpayers' money, are arrested by their Syrian Arab army whilst being evacuated from Aleppo with the terrorists. Also, the final frontier. For what? Propaganda? We take a look at the weaponization of space and how the US is hyping the threat from Russia and China whilst making the running in the weaponization space race. So, was this what the man on the moon was really all about? A cover for Nazi boffin Wernher von Braun's post-war NASA mission to dominate and weaponize space? And is the US missile defence system being installed in Eastern Europe going to spark the next Cuban missile crisis? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, Bristol's best kept Christmas secret near the arches on Gloucester Road, and the top paediatrician who was sacked by the NHS cuts managers for looking after his patients. How about that for a reason to sack somebody, eh? And emailing a prayer to his staff. If you want some real good Christmassy stuff, tomorrow, Saturday 24th of December at 4pm, Christmas celebration for children and families with music, storytelling and Christingle candles with a wonderful atmosphere. It's a great beginning to the family Christmas celebration. Even if you haven't got a family, you can still go. That's taking place at St Matthew's Church, Clare Road in Kingsdown in Bristol, just quite near the arches, which we were just talking about, and which we'll be talking about Tim Tiley, who's got a warehouse down there, or not far away, on Tuesday on the Dialect Show. But look, Martin, first of all, we've got to talk about Monday this week, where we had a bit of a double whammy, didn't we?
Presumably you're referring to the attacks in Berlin and in Ankara. Well, yes, and of course the fact when these things happen at the same time, that may also be significant as well.
I'll tell you why I think you may be right there, and that is because the Berlin Christmas market attack completely knocked assassination of the Russian ambassador totally off the headlines. I noticed the next day's newspapers, there was nobody that had it as a number one story. That was always sort of pushed back into the newspaper, off the headline.
Yeah, and you've had various US officials basically saying that we have to hit Putin and hit him hard, blah, blah, blah. And both the Russian and Turkish media are pretty firmly pointing the finger at NATO for the potentially being behind the assassination of Karlov. The attacks in Berlin, we again had this situation where a terrorist, supposedly a professional terrorist, leaves his own documentation in the cab, like the Koachi brothers in Berlin, or like Mohammed Atta's passport, which turned up on 9/11. And then, of course, immediately we have a whole story about, oh, yes, we knew all about him all along, it's this guy, blah, 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 blah. And everybody said, and of course, then people say, oh, well, why were you so incompetent? Why didn't you catch him? Well, it may very well be, I suggest to people listening, that they know exactly what's going on. It's not even clear that this guy did it. We've been told that he did it, and he's now dead because he's been assassinated in Italy, I understand, this afternoon. So we're never going to find out.
Well, that was early hours of this morning. But, yeah, let's start with the Berlin and lorry attack. First of all, yeah, there's all sorts of very strange stuff been going on about who was actually the driver, because the person that the German police were telling us for the first 24 hours after that attack, it looks as if even they didn't really believe he did it. So why that first 24 hours is quite crucial. Why would we be being told it was done by some Pakistani who actually all he'd done, apparently, was jump a red light?
Well, I don't know. This is a question that needs to be answered. Now, the fact is that the police ought to have an independent investigative power to look into this, and that one of the suspicions that they must have is that the secret services have orchestrated the attack. And people shouldn't say, oh, that's conspiracy theory, we don't want to hear that. We know that NATO intelligence services in the past orchestrated attacks in Germany, for example, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre, which was in the 1990s, I believe, and various other incidents, the assassination of Herrhausen by the Red Brigades, Red Army Fraction, sorry. Many people believe that that was actually facilitated by the intelligence services because of what he was up to in terms of negotiations with Gorbachev on behalf of Kohl. Now, the point is that we don't know what happened here, but don't presume that you do know.
Also fascinating that one of the leaders of Pegida, who's the sort of equivalent of UKIP over in Germany, tweeted on Monday that the guy who German police and intelligence services only told us on Wednesday was their chief suspect.
Well, that could well be the intelligence services salting the stew, couldn't it? So they tip off the head of Pegida, wink, wink, and say, oh, we know he's going to do this, it's this guy. Oh, and then he just leaves his passport in the his ID documents in the cab. Oh, and then we found him in Italy, oh, now he's dead. Ah, well, what that suggests to me is it's an orchestrated attack, but not. And don't forget that we know that the Islamist extremists that are operating in Syria have all been armed and trained by our own intelligence services. The story that you also mentioned at the top of the hour about the GCC and Gulf Cooperation Council and NATO intelligence officers arrested in Aleppo is very fascinating. Now, all we have at the moment is the Syrians' word for this. So let's just put a word of caution into this. But they've certainly given the names of the people they say they've captured, including one US citizen and one Israeli citizen and lots of Saudi citizens.
Another thing which, of course, is possible because the original lorry driver, Polish guy's body was found in the cab, and yet it seems that they didn't search the cab, the German police, and didn't find the ID of Anis Amri, who they're now saying did it.
Well, they did in the end search the cab and find it also. Now, you see, the point is it could be that the police planted the ID, or it could be that the ID was planted by somebody else. But in any case, I think there's a big alarm bell that should be ringing. Terrorists do not go off to carry out attacks taking their documents with them. And then when they've carried out the attack, they don't leave their documents where like the Kouachi brothers supposedly left their documents in the getaway car.
Well, yesterday, the German police were saying, it's not just the ID card, we also found some fingerprints.
This begins to make me suspect that the police are in on it. Now, that doesn't mean the police aren't always in on it. I mean, in Nice, for example, in a similar kind of attack, the local police were told by the DGSC, the French Secret Service, that they should wipe the video footage of the attack. And, of course, the locals will say, well, why would we want to do that?
Well, it didn't necessarily happen here at all, did it? I mean, there wasn't any CCTV in this, and that's another aspect
that's
to all
right.
of this, is that on Wednesday this week, there's been an acceptance by the German politicians that they are now going to roll out CCTV right across all major German cities.
Indeed, and that might be part of the plan and the purpose behind all of this attack. In France, local police actually arrested what they thought was an ISIS cell. They found ISIS flags, everything you might find for an ISIS cell, and it turned out that they were just part of an exercise being run by the intelligence services, reported in the local press in the south of France. I think we might be able to get a link up on our show page later to that, but hardly reported to anybody else.
Well, we certainly will do, Martin. We will make sure there is a link to that because, you know, it's always great to be able to follow these things up on our show page, which is thisweek.org.uk. And also, I think it's very useful to have a look at this character, Anis Amri, to find out who it is all about, because I think there's a lot of journalists who've been covering this from around the world. They're absolutely gobsmacked to find that the person that they've been told was behind it wasn't behind it at all, and actually the person who was behind it, apparently, the security services in Germany have been following for months and months, and all even tried to deport him. That wasn't just following him, they knew that he was planning acts of terror.
And then, all of a sudden, just like in Nice, where the police were blocking off the corniche and then suddenly moved their vehicles so that this vehicle suddenly turns up and crashes into it, suddenly this guy, who's been watched for months, supposedly, suddenly he's not watched at all in the moment when he does this attack. Although, of course, we're not sure he did do the attack.
Let's go back to
the
7-7 London bombings for a minute, because we had three of the four suspects for the 7-7 London bombings were also being watched and watched by MI5 for months, in fact years, two of them, beforehand, and yet we were told at the time, we didn't know anything about this guy.
Well, it's quite possible that they were recruited by MI5. This is the issue, isn't it? And people say, the intelligence services don't do things like that. And I say, yes, they do. We've got documentary evidence, police investigations in Italy, Belgium and elsewhere.
Well, on last week's show,
shadow of a doubt that NATO intelligence services have engaged in terrorism.
On last week's show, we pointed out, and The Guardian pointed out, all the mainstream press briefly pointed out, that the £3,000 funding for the Brussels terror attacks actually came from MI5 themselves.
Yes, indeed. And the guy who supplied the money for them was working for MI5 and has just been sent down.
And the only reason he was sent down is because the judge held that information out from the... Even though we all know it now, held it away from the jury.
Well, the suspicion has got to be that MI5 and other intelligence agencies from the West orchestrated the attack, because they certainly knew it was going to take place if they supplied the funding. Wouldn't you suggest?
What would you say are the characteristics of a Gladio C style attack? This is the idea of Gladio A taking place mostly in the 1970s. Gladio B, Sybil Edmonds talks about as this operation against a lot of Eastern European countries and countries around Afghanistan, places like that, Islamist terrorists over there. And now this new form in Europe.
Yeah. Gladio C, as you may call it. Well,
what are the fingerprints of that?
The supposed perpetrators, both the assassination of the Russian ambassador and of this attack in Berlin, are extremists of the Islamist variety, at least ostensibly, but which we know to have intimate linkages with the Turkish secret services MIT and with our own secret services MI6, who've been recruiting them and sending them out there to overthrow Assad. And I don't think there's any doubt about that that's what they've been doing. In fact, they've been trumpeting from the rooftops that they have been doing it.
Well, what about people who say this is just blowback? This is just people who are now... maybe they can't carry on fighting in places like Syria, so they've now come back to Europe.
Well, that's the minimum that you could say about this, is that you have created these groups, like Al-Nusra or Al-Sham, Al-Qaeda in East Aleppo. We have been presented by the liberal media here, including The Guardian, etc., that these people are freedom fighters and they're trying to liberate Syria from the terrible oppression of Assad and all the rest of it. But they are Al-Qaeda, who is supposedly... It's been fighting since 2001. We've killed millions of people to try and get Al-Qaeda, but it just turns out that we are working with them directly. And Petraeus, who was in charge in Iraq and Afghanistan, saying, well, I think we should openly support Al-Qaeda in Syria. I mean, they are supporting Al-Qaeda, but they're saying, well, we should openly support them. Now, if people can't see what's wrong with that, then they need a word with themselves. We are under assault
to the original question?
But it's not from caves in Afghanistan, is it?
The original question, which is what do the fingerprints of a Gladio C-style attack here in Europe, in Britain or in Europe, look like?
Well, I think one of the obvious things is when things that you can't quite believe are a part of the story, like the so-called professional terrorists who carry out a professional hit like the Kouachi brothers did in Paris, then take their documents with them at all and then leave the documents in a getaway car so that they can be immediately identified, then assassinated, and then that's the end. We've solved the problem. Like, see this guy's been killed now? It means we're never going to find out what happened in this incident.
Well,
the incident is now closed.
There won't be any trial.
There won't be any trial or any further investigation. We now know what happened, so everybody can... Nothing to see here, folks. We know what happened here. It's this guy. He did it. End of discussion. But, of course, that's not the end of the discussion. And, of course...
It certainly won't be on this show.
No.
Anyway, let's go to Wednesday evening's ITV News, because they did quite an interesting report. Who is this guy? Anis Amri, 24 years old, a Tunisian asylum seeker in Germany, who is supposed to have carried out this attack in the Christmas market in Berlin on Monday.
His name is Anis Amri. Though he uses six different aliases, he's Tunisian, but with fake documents claims three nationalities. He sounds mysterious, but he's well known to German authorities as a suspected criminal. Today, a state minister said the suspect was well known to them for links to Islamist extremism.
Die Sicherheitsbehörden haben ihre Erkenntnis und ihre Information zu dieser Person.
The security agencies exchanged information about this person in the counter-terrorism centre in November, he said. The local state officials for criminal investigations eventually initiated proceedings with federal prosecutors because of suspicion of preparation for a criminal offence endangering national security. He was identified not through advanced investigation, but from a discarded document left in the cab of a lorry. A day after it was removed, the crime scene cleared. Only now are his details being circulated. Anis Amri was born in 1992 in Tunisia, but left 7 years ago. He arrived in Germany in July last year and moved to Berlin in February. His application for asylum was rejected 6 months ago because authorities in his home country denied he was a Tunisian citizen. He was awaiting replacement ID papers, which German officials confirmed had arrived today. The German foreign minister laid a single rose, but his government cannot explain why the attacker wasn't stopped.
Can you reflect on the mood in Berlin?
He's given a statement.
Would you like to say anything about the investigation? It seems that a suspect being identified three days on is...
I think he has given a statement and that's fine.
But he's views on the investigation.
What this? I mean, as I said, the minister has given a statement. You've been there, so that's fine.
The suspect was known to have links to the man thought to be featured in this video. a 32-year-old Iraqi who was arrested last month and is described as Germany's IS leader. The agony is compounded by the questions. Could what happened here have been prevented? And will it ever be explained? Rohit Khatru, ITV News, Berlin.
Yes, that was a report on Wednesday. Martin Rohit did a really good job there, actually. He went and approached the German Foreign Minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, as he was laying a white rose at the scene, saying, well, what went wrong? Why has it taken you 3 days to, after the attack to actually tell the world who you're looking for? And then suddenly, within another 24 hours, this guy's been shot dead.
Well, we're also presuming that he actually did it, which, of course, is not proven at all.
I mean, why is the Foreign
Minister... That's who they're saying who did it.
Why has the Foreign Minister got nothing to say? He was sort of looking very sheepish behind, and he was just sort of wanting to get out of
the
camera shot.
Well, it's quite possible that Steinmeier is quite a sophisticated character. He may know more than he's allowed to say, and he may suspect what we suspect as people... I'm trying to think now that the German former minister who's very aware of these kind of issues... 9/11 included. I'm racking my brain for him.
Andreas von Bülow, former German defence minister.
Steinmeier's sophisticated enough probably to understand the kind of argument we're making, but then he's not in a position to say anything, even if he knows anything.
So he's got to... I mean, surely he could explain, at least to give some idea of why it's taken the German authorities so long to even just identify the person who's clearly the main...
He was identified because they found a document in the cab, and I stress again, when did you ever hear, for example, of provisional IRA terrorists leaving their documents around when they go out and carry out attacks? Why would you do that? Why would you even take a document with you if you're going on an operation like that? You wouldn't.
Is there any prospect of the German authorities being sacked for not... I mean, this guy, as we were just hearing there, is a close associate of the leader of Islamic State in Germany.
So they say. So they say. In other words, we've now been given a complete story. This is an IS attack. He's linked to this guy that's already been blamed to be IS.
I mean, it's okay. Look, even if it isn't true, it just sounds like there, that some heads need to roll in Germany if it is true.
Yeah, but you're presuming that the basis of the story is true. It could very well be that the BND, working with MI6 and others, coordinated this whole attack, as the SISMI used to do in Italy. And that's the sort of thing that serious police officers ought to be asking.
The other thing is, it's not impossible that this Scania lorry was actually hacked and driven remotely.
Indeed, that's possible. I mean, that can be done, can't it? And, of course, it also bears similarities with the attack in Nice. And the purpose of this, of course, attacking a Christmas market with a Muslim, supposed Muslim attacker, is to reinforce this narrative that Western Christian civilization is under attack, where it's very dangerous, and now I'm afraid we're going to need more powers, we're going to need
lots
more CCTV,
of money, lots of money to be spent,
blah, blah,
on
loads right, more yeah. money to be spent on our activities. I mean, you'd have thought, with all of the incompetence being shown by the intelligence services, they shouldn't get any more budget for all of this.
Well,
but no, they will get more budget,
won't they?
What
the intelligence services will be saying is, we need more money to be able to follow more people. We just didn't have enough money to fund this guy.
But it could well be that they're orchestrating the attacks. And this is the sort of thing that it's absolutely legitimate for us to mention. We know that the Red Army faction was infiltrated. We know that loyalist and Republican factions in Ireland were infiltrated. We know that the Red Brigades were infiltrated. We know that Al-Qaeda was set up to fight in Afghanistan in the 1980s by the Western intelligence services, but they claim they lost control of them, even though they're still working with them in Syria today.
Also, Russia's ambassador to Turkey is assassinated by apparently an off-duty police officer in front of terrified witnesses in retaliation for the crisis in Aleppo. First of all, Martin, I suppose the obvious question is, if this guy was an off-duty police officer, how was he able to sort of pose as someone who was part of the ambassador's security detail, Mr. Karloff's security detail?
Well, because he was an insider, he managed to infiltrate himself in, but no doubt he had some help to get in there. But neither the Russians nor the Turks accept that this is an individual who's just done this on his own bat. Both of them suspect Fethullah Gulen, who's a CIA asset work based in US. It may be that it suits both parties to point the finger in that direction, so you can't necessarily take that face value either.
Some have pointed out that pictures of him shot afterwards lying on the floor, he seems to have a couple of day old stubble on that body, and yet this guy, when he shot him a few minutes before, didn't have any stubble. He was clean shaven.
Well, it may be that the chap's escaped. And that in actual fact, whoever did it, whoever they say they've shot. I mean, isn't it funny that they shoot these people? What I'd want to do if I was the police, I'd want to arrest them and interrogate them.
I mean, if he was a follower of
the Gulen... But of course, if they're all dead.
If he was a police
officer... Nothing more to be done, is there?
If he was a police officer who was a follower of the Gulen movement, how come he hadn't been purged by Erdogan after the coup?
Well, apparently he had been purged. I understand that he had been purged, and I think that's the story that both Turks and Russians are sticking to at the minute. But of course, they're both pointing the finger at the CIA there. Can the elected leadership of Russia and the elected leadership of Turkey say the CIA are assassins? I think they can, because the CIA are assassins. They've always been assassins.
During the attack, he said, I'm just trying to find his name again, actually. It's Melvut Mert Altintas. That was the name of the assassin. All caught on film, of course. He said, don't forget Aleppo. Don't forget Syria. So long as our brothers are not in safety, you'll not taste safety either. Only my dead body will leave here. Anyone who has a role in this oppression, they will all die one by one. Well, apparently, part of that, anyway, is similar to the unofficial anthem of the Al-Nusra Front.
Indeed. And so he was working with Al-Nusra, as were British Special Forces until very recently, the White Helmets, set up by James Le Mesurier, based in Turkey, cooperating with MIT, like this chap, and the Al-Nusra Front. And as an ambassador dead. And I suppose what the Russians could say is, well, British ambassadors, watch your backs, eh? Watch your backs.
The conclusion that some have come to, Martin, is that Western governments, diplomats and media directed the gun that murdered the ambassador Andrei Karlov.
Well, that's being said by the pro-government press in Turkey and the pro-government press in Russia.
Well, what does this mean for Turkey's alignment, east or west?
Well, if it was an attempt to... I think what's happened with this is it's actually pushed the Russians and the Turks together. So if it was an attempt to push them apart, it wasn't very successful. But I think because of the success of Russian arms in Syria, there's an element within the Western intelligence services that wants to punish Russia, even though it doesn't serve a useful purpose. They just feel that they have to actually respond, otherwise the Russians are getting away with stuff. So I think that's probably the most likely explanation of what we've got here. But we don't know, and probably we never will know what really went on.
Well, I don't agree with you. I think often these things do come out in the mix.
Well, they do sometimes, and sometimes they don't, Tony. But I think the presumption... Erdogan, for example, after the Paris attacks, he made a speech in Paris where he said he felt that the hands of the Israelis were involved in the attack. It wasn't widely reported in Western media, it was reported in Turkey. And, of course, it's perfectly legitimate and reasonable for a Turkish president to imagine that Israel might be involved in terrorist attacks in France. Perfectly reasonable. But you talk to mainstream media in the West, and they go, oh, no, it couldn't possibly be true. No, they don't do things like that. I say, oh, yes, they do. They do. Everybody does. They're all doing it.
Also, Egyptian police this week have arrested a film crew faking Syria scenes over in Egypt. So what was that all about? That's pretty shocking. Very, very little reporting on that, but it certainly seems to be pretty well documented. The Egyptians found these people doing some filming with some children and fake blood and arrested them.
Yeah, well, that's because the Egyptian military are starting to align with the Syrian military to defeat, Islamist extremism. So one of the things they're doing is trying to catch them creating these kind of fake news stories. But, of course, we've also had this little girl, 7-year-old girl, based inside eastern Aleppo, who's been tweeting madly for weeks about how terrible it is in eastern Aleppo in perfect English and immediately being picked up by all these kind of top journalists and celebrities. celebrities, and that they've not been able to find any trace of her in eastern Aleppo. And also, of course, the white helmets we've
heard. What do you mean they've not been able to find any trace of her?
They've not been able to find any trace of her. She's suddenly gone off the Twitter sphere. She was a seven-year-old, and she was blogging with all this so-called...
Let's also remember, the Pentagon was paying Bell Pottinger, wasn't it? Hundreds of millions of pounds to create fake films, fake footage for the news.
They've been interviewing all of these people who've been liberated from East Aleppo and said, well, what do you think of the white helmets? And they go, what? They never even heard of them.
I think it might be a good time to put link on our show page back to that article, because Bell Pottinger, strategic communication company, big public relations firm, it's pretty obvious that they have been manufacturing, filming fake footage, dramatising footage, and then presenting it as news.
Yeah, and of course, when they do things like that, with our money, because it's our taxes that pay for that, then we're definitely suspects in things like the Berlin truck attack, aren't they? If you're going to lie like that to confuse the public with our resources, then it's perfectly legitimate for the police to presume that you may well be behind the attacks as well and go after you.
The team in Egypt admitted to the Egyptian police they plan to distribute their work on social media, pretending it showed scenes of injured and destruction in Aleppo, the embattled northern Syrian city, which has just fallen back under government control. It was not immediately clear what charges have been brought against the five people, and the Independent contacted the Egyptian authorities for clarification in a distinctly amateur raw video and stills recorded by the Interior Ministry. An eight-year-old girl wears a white dress and bandages covered in red stains and holds a teddy bear. A 12-year-old boy is also interviewed about what life is like under intensive Russian-backed Syrian government airstrikes.
Yeah, except there are no Russian government airstrikes in Egypt, are there?
Also, this week we've heard of a whole load of intelligence officers from the West being arrested in eastern Aleppo. This is coming up from the Syrian government.
It is, and therefore we've only got one source for it. But if they have, in fact, got an Israeli, an American, and a bunch of Saudis and Qataris under arrest, then it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I mean, previously I think they have arrested people and caught people, but they've just been exchanged behind the scenes. What the Syrians are planning to be doing in this situation is saying, right, we've got these people, what do you want us to do with them? Should we charge them with terrorism? Or would you like to negotiate with us about what's happening?
Mostly Americans, Israelis, also from the Gulf states. But these intelligence officers, what exactly have they been doing in there? And, I mean, of course, this is, again,
pretending to be the white helmets and providing support for the anti-tank and anti-aircraft kit that the rebels have been using.
We know that the West's been helping with all sorts of targeting and that sort of thing, so maybe they're just helping helping the terrorists to know when the Syrian Arab Army or the Russians are going to attack on a particular front.
Well, there was an attack upon a Russian hospital which killed Russian medical personnel a couple of weeks ago. And the Russians definitely suspected, because normally the rebels were just firing at random into government-controlled territory, hitting anything they could hit. But on this particular occasion, they got a very direct hit on this Russian hospital. And the Syrians and the Russians are pretty convinced that was because of NATO giving basically information
to the terrorists. In the background to all of this, the UK is secretly selling arms to Saudi Arabia and elsewhere under an opaque licensing system. This is reported last weekend. The military and defence industry is a major player in the UK economy, worth about $7.7 billion a year, something like half of that money coming from Saudi Arabia. Many of the countries buying British arms are run by governments with dubious human rights records. According to the I newspaper, an increasing number of military consignments are being sold under the Open Individual Export Licence after... quiet government encouragement in 2015, despite criticism from MPs. Under these licences, numerous consignments can be exported to one destination under a single licence for up to 5 years after initial scrutiny. They're supposed to be less sensitive goods, but campaigners say this is not appropriate for deadly weapons.
Well, quite. And, you know, that's been going on for years. Part of our entanglement with the Saudi regime, which it certainly is, they don't have elections in Saudi Arabia, is partly from there's a lot of money to be made. You know, plenty of ministers have got fingers in the pies like British Aerospace and so on. So there's money to be made. And also there's the general strategy of aligning with Islamist terrorism of the Salafi Wahhabi variety as part of the general geopolitical struggle against the resistance axis in the Middle East, Chinese and Russian misbehaviour, as they see
with Syria,
elsewhere.
Turkish air raids have killed 47 civilians, we hear today from Press TV, in Syria's Al-Bab. This is a monitoring group saying this. Turkish jets conducted fresh airstrikes on Syria's northwest city of Al-Bab, leaving 47 civilians dead, another act of aggression against the Arab country. The so-called Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said 14 children and 9 women were among the fatalities of Thursday's aerial assaults. Turkish warplanes regularly carry out airstrikes in support of their ground incursion into Syria. Now, one does wonder if the Turks and the Russians are going to start firing air-to-air missiles at some point at each other, Martin.
Well, it may be that the fact is that the Turks are flying into Syria and not being shot down by the Russians, which they could easily be. So I think there's a kind of understanding between them about who's allowed to do what and where. Otherwise, they'd already have been knocking them down.
Also, the US Army is deploying tanks to Europe. Hey, thanks, guys. Ratcheting up tensions with Russia. They've been wanting the Americans to get the Europeans to fight the Russians ever since the end of World War II and Churchill's mad idea that he wanted to nuke Moscow, haven't they?
Well, yes, but of course this is more recent. I mean, in military terms,
this is last week. Yeah,
yeah. In military terms, the so-called build-up by NATO in Eastern Europe is ludicrous.
Well, the US Army in Europe is due to deploy a total of 4,000 American troops and 2,000 vehicles on a rotational basis to Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and the Baltic nations. NATO forces will move to the Baltic states in early spring.
Yeah, but the point is that none of these forces are sufficiently robust to take on the Russian military. No way, Jose. Now, the Russian military, in fact, has no intention of invading any of these countries, so a lot of this is essentially grandstanding. It's just as well that the Russians are very calm, because they could take offence at all of this, because it's basically directed at them. It's sabre-rattling, as Steinmeier, who we mentioned earlier, has called it. But the fact is that it's of no military threat to the Russians whatsoever. What is a military threat is the anti-missile missiles which have been put into Poland and Romania, which could potentially start a first strike, nuclear strike on the
US Federation. US forces plan to conduct more than 90 manoeuvres with NATO allies and European partners next year, including Swift Response 17 in July, to test the NATO rapid response units. Swift response exercises designed to demonstrate NATO's ability to respond to a crisis within 18 hours of notification. The deployment breaches the NATO-Russia Founding Act 1997. By signing the document, NATO pledged not to seek additional permanent stationing of substantial ground forces in the nations closer to Russia.
Yeah, in other words, this is a symbolic flouting of an agreement with the Russians. It's got no military significance. I can imagine the Russian military just rolling their eyes as they watch these twerps go about their business. But, of course, what it is a deliberate tweaking of the nose of the Russians, because they've got an agreement with the Russians that they're not going to put these kind of forces in, but they're putting them in. And they're doing it on the back of what happened in Ukraine and so on.
The post-9/11 world, we started off with Afghanistan and Iraq, places quite far away, but it looks as if the Americans are moving their troops and their bases and building bases closer and closer to, obviously here in Europe, but also around China too. This whole thing sort of kicked off with 9/11, and I thought it would be interesting to see what Donald Trump has had to say about 9/11 since he's about to take over as US president next year. So let's have a listen now to a phone call that Donald Trump made to a US radio station, or TV station I think it actually was, on 9/11 itself. So this is Donald Trump speaking on September the 11th back in 2001.
Well, it was an architectural defect. You know, the World Trade Center was always known as a very, very strong building. Don't forget, that took a big bomb in the basement. Now, the basement is the most vulnerable place because that's your foundation. And it withstood that. And I got to see that area about 3 or 4 days after it took place, because one of my structural engineers actually took me for a tour because he did the building. And I said, I can't believe it. The building was standing solid and half of the columns were blown out. I mean, so this was an unbelievably powerful building. If you know anything about structure, it was one of the first buildings that was built from the outside. The steel, the reason the World Trade Center had such narrow windows is that in between all the windows, you had the steel on the outside. So you had the steel on the outside of the building. That's why when I first looked, and you had big, heavy I-beams. When I first looked at it, I couldn't believe it, because there was a hole in the steel. And this is steel that was, you remember the width of the windows in the World Trade Center, folks. I think, you know, if you were ever up there, they were quite narrow. And in between was this heavy steel. I said, how could a plane, even a 767 or 747 or whatever it might have been, how could it possibly go through the steel? I happen to think that they had not only a plane, but they had bombs that exploded almost simultaneously, because I just can't imagine anything being able to go through that wall. Most buildings are built with the steel is on the inside around the elevator shaft. This one was built from the outside, which is the strongest structure you can have, and it was almost just like a can of soup.
You know, Donald.
So, in other words, Donald Trump, who does know something about skyscrapers, pointed out the obvious, that in actual fact these buildings couldn't possibly have been brought down by planes crashing into them, which of course is the position of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, headed by Richard Gage, the architect, which has been campaigning on this issue for many years.
Well, what he's effectively saying is he thinks that there were bombs that went off in the building that allowed the planes to penetrate into the middle of the building. I think that's what he's saying, isn't it?
Well, he's saying that the planes themselves couldn't possibly
have
brought the building down.
There were bombs in the buildings, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and there were bombs in the building. I think that's pretty clear. Anybody who knows anything about this would draw the relevant conclusion, including Donald Trump. And of course, the bombs in the building were not placed there by people from Afghanistan. They were placed there by somebody on the inside, the people who had access to the building, the people who owned the building. Larry Silverstein and his cabal of investors, who got a massive insurance payout on the back of this terrorist attack, which they, of course, probably orchestrated.
Yeah, and also he was looking at an enormous bill to remove asbestos from the World Trade Center, and he decided... Oh,
and also all of the steel from the building was carted away by Rudy Giuliani, who was mayor of New York at the time, and sent to China to be turned into, you know, our Christmas presents this year, no doubt. That was actually wrong, because you'd have thought when buildings like that collapse, you'd want to know how, you'd want to know why. You'd want to look into why these buildings just suddenly collapse like that.
Certainly,
and why are skyscrapers still open?
I mean,
if skyscrapers can just collapse like that, we should close them all down, shouldn't we?
Certainly, if 9/11 is anything to go by, it's massively changed the US foreign policy. It's given them what they feel, anyway, is a carte blanche not only to deploy over in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Middle East, all over Africa, etc., but in Europe too. Anyway, so I just thought we'd take a look, because quite a few people have asked me over the last few months about why am I not appearing on Russia Today anymore? So I thought I'd kind of scratch my head and ask myself the same question. And I'll play you now one of the penultimate clips of me being on Russia Today channel, where I was asked to comment on a British report into the death of Alexander Litvinenko, the Russian spy who was poisoned with polonium here in London. And this is what I had to say.
The absolute nub of this issue is the research that Litvinenko had been doing into the Moscow-Ryazan bombings of 1999, which helped spark the Chechen War, a terrorist attack that happened in Russia in 1999. The book he wrote, Blowing Up Russia, most of your listeners won't have time to have read it, but I did. And you'll find in there that there is evidence that actually points to Putin being behind those attacks, but also to Boris Berezovsky, who was removed as a criminal from Russia by Putin, and he found his home in London. Now, when Berezovsky was in London, he was being funded by two people we know about. One was the Duke of Kent, and probably the security services too. So what Litvinenko was saying effectively was that possibly Berezovsky was the main instigator of these attacks in Russia, not Putin. So I would advise people that want to look deeper into this to look at this book, Blowing Up Russia, but also to bear in mind that Berezovsky may have been the main instigator of those terrorist attacks. Certainly his death, Berezovsky, in 2013 here in London was very suspicious. It may have put Berezovsky out of the way, because he had some very important evidence that he could possibly have given that would have made this inquest and this public inquiry much more interesting, where many secrets would have come out.
Yeah, so that's me speaking earlier this year on RT, Russia Today channel. Martin, these attacks, the Moscow bombings, there were basically massive blocks of flats which were blown to pieces in 1999. There were several of these attacks, but they were a kind of 9/11 for Russia. Many people haven't heard of them.
Yeah, I would refer to them as 999, because they all happened in September 99. So if you wanted to have a moniker for them, that's what you would say is 999. You've got to remember what the political situation was in Russia at that stage, which was that prior to the Zyuganov and the Communist Party were set fair to win the 1998 elections in Russia. And Putin came forward as a result of machinations by Berezovsky and others. And at that stage...
Well, Putin was from the FSB.
But in other words, the oligarchy got very panicked that the Communist Party was going to win the election in Russia. Now, in actual fact, that wouldn't have been abnormal in the rest of Europe, Eastern Europe, including in Poland, for example. The former Communists had won the second election. Once people had a good taste of Thatcherism over there, and I used to work over there, they got pretty disillusioned pretty damn quickly. And therefore, they started to think in terms of going back to some aspects of the old system. Now, there was a big lobby of oligarchs in Russia and Western advisers and Western intelligence services who were absolutely horrified by that idea. How can we explain to the ordinary folk of Britain that the Russians have just re-elected the Communist Party? So we'll have to do something to stop this. So they all did. They all got together and stopped it. At that stage, Putin was seen as a cat's paw for Western intelligence services. Because what Zyuganov said in the election campaign was, this is now a straight fight between the KGB and the Communist Party.
Well,
and I call upon people to vote for the Communist Party.
Putin took over as president in 2000, and then he kind of turned the tables on Berezovsky, didn't he? Pretty much straight away.
Yeah, I think what happened was Putin represents what's called the Siloviki, which are the kind, you know, the old intelligence structure of the country, and they were happy enough to go along with whatever was required to prevent the communists taking power. But then they also had their own views about what the oligarchy should and shouldn't be doing. And they basically said to the oligarchy, Berezovsky being the leader of the oligarchy, we are now in charge. You've messed things up. It's time for us to run the show.
As one of the top people at the FSB when Putin was there, and also as acting prime minister, to allow Berezovsky to get away with these attacks, Berezovsky may have thought, well, hey, this guy, I can trust him, he can be my puppet.
That's what he thought, but Putin was smarter than he was. Now, Berezovsky, I think, was murdered by MI6, because what Berezovsky was saying quite frequently was that, why don't we use this stuff against Putin? We know he was involved in these kind of attacks, because I was involved with them too. But, of course, Berezovsky's got a big mouth, basically, and eventually he's becoming an embarrassment. Because Putin's obvious response to that is, we know everything that happened on 9/11. Do you want us to start talking about that?
Yes, he certainly was being paid by... He was working for MI6, Litvinenko. That BBC dug that
I think
out.
He murdered Litvinenko as well, because he's trying to set Putin up.
One thing I would say, though, is Berezovsky... I said on there that the Duke of Kent was paying Berezovsky. It was the other way round. Duke of Kent, of course, is a major figure in Anglo-Russian relations. He speaks fluent Russian. He's the top Freemason in Britain, the Duke of Kent, as well.
Yeah, and I think, don't forget that when the police investigated the Litvinenko case and they found polonium, and you've asked yourself the question, why would anybody use polonium, which is so traceable, to murder somebody? But they found traces of polonium in Berezovsky's office. In other words, I think Berezovsky murdered Litvinenko in order to create an incident with Putin, because he was running out of options, Berezovsky. He wanted to replace Putin, and he was that ambitious.
And he was running out of money.
Yeah.
Having been a very rich person over in
but
Russia.
But, I mean, because he was becoming a loose cannon.
There is a point
because
here,
he was going
Martin,
on and point, on and on about 999.
There's a point here, Martin, and that is that it's a pity that you can't... It's very difficult to criticise Putin or even talk about, for example, the Russian Communist Party on RT. All of these major mainstream media nowadays, they really do seem to be quite propagandistic. They're just pushing their point of view.
Well, I think that...
But don't you think that maybe in any kind of coming war, if there is an international news service out there that will criticise their own people as well, that they could well win that war? Because so much of it is an information war.
It is, and what happens is, by playing one off against another, we can gradually get the truth out there. I think Berezovsky was largely responsible for 999. I think Putin may have had a hand in it, but he wasn't the main player. And I think that behind what you've got to remember, that when the bombs went off in Moscow in 1999, the people behind it were very similar to the oligarchs who planted bombs in Bologna railway station in 1980. It was virtually exactly the same NATO game plan. We've got to stop the communists winning elections, so we've got to kill some ordinary people. Same in Russia, same in Italy.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Anyway, we're going to talk space wars now. And our first clip is from this documentary just out from CNN, a very dramatic film, and it's called War in Space, The Next Battlefield. What they do there, Martin, is they give us an idea of what a sort of a cyberspace attack will be coming from space, and also kind of crippling US satellites, that kind of thing.
As the sun sets and the nation goes to sleep, the battle for supremacy in space is about to begin. One final night before Americans wake up to a new and daunting reality. 10 a.m. New York, 7 a.m. Los Angeles. Cities normally buzzing with the morning rush suddenly stall. TV networks start to go dark. Internet connections run slow. ATMs begin to malfunction. There's confusion. No panic, not yet. As stealth cyber attacks are racing through the U.S. at the speed of light.
Then you have the question of, is it a cascading effect or not?
By noon in New York and 9 a.m. in Los Angeles, financial markets, dependent on exact timing provided by GPS, are frozen. Mobile phone services, already patchy, fail. Confusion gives way to growing fears this is much more than a simple cyber glitch. Many traffic lights and railroad signals, also timed by GPS, default to red, bringing transport to a standstill. Commercial air traffic is grounded as pilots lose navigation and weather data. Power stations and water treatment plants begin to stop functioning.
This feels like utter science fiction, and yet it's not.
Remoting track 1-2.
By now, Americans know the country is under some kind of attack.
This is Sivers. We're attacking a space launch on it.
And they look to the armed forces to spring into action.
Stand by. Data building is closed.
But the world's greatest military is struggling to respond. Military pilots and drones lose contact with the ground. GPS-guided smart bombs are rendered dumb. Warships lose contact with commanders. This is the nightmare scenario. Chaos on Earth as our adversaries launch a massive cyber attack on key infrastructure and disable and destroy our satellites in space. The first shots in the first space war.
Well, that was a clip there from the documentary War in Space, The Next Battlefield, from CNN last month. And that gives you an idea of what they think it would be like. But there is another documentary from a couple of years ago which gives a completely different view to CNN, the official sort of primetime mainstream TV view. And that documentary is called Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. It starts by looking at the origins of space war with the Nazis and the V2, taking what they call the ultimate high ground.
Space then has been called the ultimate high ground, and the advantage to the state that can seize and maintain the high ground is the same as holding the high ground throughout history, whether that was a hill, a mountain, or in the latter half of the 20th century, the air space.
September 6, 1944, armed with over a ton of high explosives, Germany's first tactical rocket, now called the V2, the vengeance weapon, is fired at London.
That was a clip there from the film Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space.
Well, I mean, we know that this is going on. Both sides are engaged in it. The US openly call for full spectrum dominance in the Project for a New American Century document, and so on.
Now, the main person here we'll be talking about is Wernher von Braun, and he was the person who was right involved right at the very, very start over in the US.
Gentlemen, will you please take your seats so we can begin today's conference? I take a great deal of pleasure in presenting to you today as our guest speaker, Dr. Wernher von Braun.
Gentlemen, the conquest of outer space is the greatest technological challenge of the age in which we live. On the right side of this picture, you see a large wheel-shaped space station. This, of course, offers tremendous possibilities to reconnaissance, and both in the civilian sense as in the military sense.
These Nazi scientists, these Nazi space scientists that came to this country under Project Paperclip, developed schemes to essentially control the Earth from space with space-based weapons.
It seems even feasible to use such a platform in space as a base for the bombing of objects on the ground. And it is my opinion that such bombing could be carried out with an unprecedented accuracy from such a station.
There's a voice of Wernher von Braun there. Space Command, that's the US command now that deals with space, have got all their... it's basically like a new frontier, isn't it? What they do is they have drills now. And the astounding thing is that even though they're spending more and more money on space weapons, the threat is, in fact, diminishing.
Valid missile event.
I agree, that's a valid event. You have two. Retract. 0001.
Today's Air Force fights missile defense war games, in which so-called rogue nations attack American cities.
Possible impact in San Francisco, sir.
In reality, who would launch such attacks against the USA?
The interesting thing is that the threat is actually shrinking, not increasing. The ballistic missile threat is declining. There are far fewer ballistic missiles in the world now than there were 15 years ago. There are fewer countries with ballistic missile programs. There are fewer hostile countries to the United States with ballistic missile programs. When you look at it, it really comes down to a handful of states whose programs we worry about, North Korea and Iran, basically, and they only have medium-range missiles. That is, they can't reach the United States.
Of course, the fact of the matter is that this has now become an offensive program, certainly not a defensive one.
What America is doing is not about defense. It's about offense. It's about an aggressive military doctrine that talks about control and domination. I really went through an entire transformation. Everything that I knew was different. But one thing wasn't different. One thing always remained. I realized I had a good heart, even as a conservative, as a young follower of the military. I had a good heart. I had a good intention. And I realized that many people in the military are that way, that they have a good heart. They mean well. They're doing what they think is the right thing to do. They want to protect the country.
There are moments that will truly test the leader within you, test whether you will take the hard path or the easy path, the wrong path, or the right path.
Most people want to have a good heart, and that when you challenge them to think, it doesn't mean that they change overnight. I didn't change overnight. It took me some time behind those gates on that military base for me to make my change, but it's all about initiating that change.
The willingness always to take the right path, even if it's the hard path, is called character. In every aspect of your life, whether personal or professional, you must always maintain the courage of your convictions, your personal integrity.
We're living in a very, very dangerous time, and there's hardly any alarm in this area across the board. I mean, people are just, they're so inundated with so many things, you know, just making a living, just getting through the day, just trying to remain sane in all this insanity that's going on. That it's hard to get their attention and saying, wait a minute, I know you think it's bad. I got news for you. It's a lot worse. People don't want to hear that, you know. So we have to find a way to alert people to the reality of what's going on. And that's not an easy task.
Congratulations. May God watch over all of you and these United States.
Lord, we pray today that you would allow us to worship you in spirit and in truth as we go out into the world.
Well, Well, that's the US military there kind of indoctrinating their people, Martin. But this is getting pretty much as if it's almost being rolled out last year, that is to say, well, this year really, in 2016, as the big thing to be worried about. There could be a massive cyber attack. You have to also remember, of course, we've got smart meters in many of our homes now. That could mean that a cyber attack can just completely knock out your electricity, your gas supply, that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, the various spokesperson for the Americans have been saying, well, we ought to carry out cyber attacks on Russia to punish them for their cyber attacks on us. And, of course, it's there was an attack on the five top Russian banks a couple of weeks ago, which was thwarted by the Russian Post Office. This is very dangerous because, of course, the Russians are quite right to be paranoid that they're under attack. In 1983, we nearly had a nuclear war as bad as, every bit as bad as a Cuban Missile Crisis, but nobody even heard about it. And that was because Reagan and Thatcher at the time were being very belligerent, and they nearly provoked a nuclear war.
If there is a massive cyber attack on the West, how will we know who's done it?
We won't. And the obvious conclusion to draw is it's a false flag, because then they will then roll out and say, and because of that, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, we're invading blah. That's what it'll be like.
How vulnerable are our ordinary homes, things like that?
Well, they're very vulnerable. I think what we saw in the fighting in Ukraine, where we saw some evidence of what the Russian military are capable of, the obvious thing for them to do is to knock out the electronics of the other side. And that they've been training for that for years.
OK, folks, don't say we didn't warn you.
Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Maliher Azazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. This week we spend the hour with Rhys Jones, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Stay with us. In the summer of 2015, a wave of refugees taking perilous sea and land crossings to get into Europe revealed one of the worst humanitarian crises in modern history. The wars in Syria and Iraq and the worsening situation in Afghanistan having forced hundreds of thousands of people to leave their homes and risk their lives to seek sanctuary elsewhere. According to the most recent reports, in 2014, 14 million people were displaced by war, the most in a single year since World War II. In the past decade, 40,000 people died trying to cross international borders. The dramatic increase in the influx of refugees to Europe has produced a rise in anti-refugee sentiments, the enactment of anti-refugee laws, and the construction of walls and fences, exacerbating the plight of millions of people who were forced to flee violence and poverty. Rhys Jones is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii in Manoa and author of several books, including his most recent, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Movement. He spoke with Malihe about his new book and the structural violence of the global border regime.
Your book, Violent Borders, explores the conflict between movement and settlement. And a good example of it is the plight of hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants who are taking dangerous journeys to find sanctuary in other countries. You also take a long view and multi-layered approach to why nation states have increasingly tried to restrict the movement of refugees and the poor. You focus your analysis on how walls have become sites of violence for millions of people who are fleeing war, persecution, and poverty. You write the hardening of the border through new security practices is the source of violence, not a response to it. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so for me, the act of
making a border and then constructing a wall on it and putting the whole range of border infrastructure that goes along with that. So it's not just the wall, but also the increases in agents that are at the border, the new surveillance technologies that are used there. And over the last 15 to 20 years, there's also a changing mentality of many border security forces that used to think of themselves as primarily doing policing work. Today, the idea of security against terrorism has infused the way that many of these agencies operate, so that they treat everyone that they encounter as if they're a potential terrorist, which, of course, very, very few are, if any. But nevertheless, they treat just regular people who are moving to look for work with that mentality of a militarized security force rather than some sort of policing mechanism. So that act of making a border is an inherently violent act. It's always about restricting someone's movement and preventing them from the opportunity to move to another place, whether it's to look for work, to visit their family, seek better opportunities for their children. So by limiting someone's movement, you're doing violence to that person.
And you give several examples in your book on the militarization of border areas, and specifically one that we are very familiar with, the U.S.-Mexico border. You write, by 2010, the Border Patrol had more than 20,000 agents. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, employs a total of 59,000 employees, including customs officers, pilots, and maritime interdiction teams. In order to hire such a large number of agents quickly, the Border Patrol removed some previous requirements, such as passing polygraph exam, and drew heavily on veterans returning from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, who make up some 30% of agents.
Yeah, and that's very evident at the U.S.-Mexico border, which I think is often emblematic of changes that are happening at a series of other borders around the world. The data that you just mentioned is quite clear on these changes that have happened at the border. At the U.S.-Mexico border, the Border Patrol in 1990 had a budget of about $300 million and had about 3,500 agents. Today, their budget is $3.5 billion, and they have over 21,000 agents. So there's been this dramatic increase in the number of agents there. And simultaneously, particularly after the U.S. embarked on its war on terror, mm-hmm. the atmosphere in the agency changed from primarily policing for possible migrants looking for work coming from Mexico or Central America to treating the border as a space where there's always this potential that a terrorist could be located there. So although the U.S. Border Patrol has located exactly zero terrorists at the U.S.-Mexico border, they nevertheless have this mentality that they have to engage with the people that they find there with the possibility that person mm-hmm. could be a terrorist. And so it means this much more militarized response. It means using military hardware at the border, and it means a lot more violence directed at the people who they encounter in that space.
How does building walls and borders connect to violence? In addition to the fact that these people who are really trying to find work or safety, they meet this hyper-militarized space. What else explains the relationship between the two? You say in order to understand the violence of border, we need to have a more nuanced definition of violence. Some argue that structural violence is really baked into the existing socioeconomic system. What is your definition of violence, and how does it apply to borders and walls?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's key to understanding the violence that borders do to the bodies of migrants, but also to the environment as well. First of all, there's clearly direct violence at borders. There are border agents killing people who are moving through border spaces at a number of different borders around the world. We see that at the U.S.-Mexico border, where in the past 5 years, about 33 people have been shot and killed by the Border Patrol. You see that at the Turkey-Syria border, where the Turkish border guards have been accused of killing a number of people trying to flee Syria and cross into Turkey. Eritrea as well has a fairly long history now of preventing people from leaving the country. And so border guards there as well have orders to shoot people who are leaving, trying to escape from Eritrea. But probably the border that has the largest amount of direct violence, where border agents are killing people, civilians predominantly, in border areas, is actually the India-Bangladesh border, which is one that doesn't come to a lot of people's minds. But in the past 15 years, the Bangladesh government and NGOs that gather data on this have found that over 1,000 Bangladeshi citizens have been shot and killed by the Indian Border Security Force. And it's for the similar reason as the U.S.-Mexico border. The Indian Border Security Force is told that they're the front line against terrorism and that it's their duty to prevent terrorist infiltrations into India. And so if they perceive that movements in border areas are terrorism, they have the authority to shoot and kill people, and they have been at a fairly staggering rate. So that's the direct violence of the border, which accounts for a portion of the deaths that we see at borders and the violence that borders do.
You were talking about India-Bangladesh border. You write in your book, the Indian border fence blocked traditional elephant migration. This is also the violence perpetuated against the environment. Blocked traditional elephant migration routes along the border with Bangladesh and funneled elephants to more populated areas. From 2002 to 2015, 226 people were killed by elephants and 62 elephants were killed by people, forcing the Indian government to reopen corridors for elephants to pass through the area. But the violence against the humans just continues to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is something that's interesting about the way that we think about borders often, is that the fact that it affects animal migrations often seems to be more important to some people than the effect that it has on human migrations. Mm-hmm. It seems to be okay that hardening borders in the way that we have is forcing people to take these more dangerous routes, and that the border security forces are killing people at the border. But if it affects elephants, or if it affects the javelino on the U.S.-Mexico border, that seems to arouse in some ways more public sympathy for these issues.
So talk about the indirect violence.
Yeah, so indirect violence at the border. So in addition to those direct killings by the border security forces, the indirect violence is by hardening the border, by making it harder to cross through border areas. The result has been that many people are funneled to ever more dangerous places to cross the border. So if you look back to the 1980s and the 1990s, both at the edges of the European Union, the edges of the U.S., and another number of other places where people are trying to move today, the India-Bangladesh border as well, it was relatively easy to cross through these spaces. Mm-hmm. You could cross between cities, you could cross in areas that were heavily populated, so that there was a safe way to cross across the borders. These countries were already starting to do border enforcement during this period, so you had to take some efforts. You might have to engage with a smuggler to help you to do it, but it was fairly easy to do. And during that period of time, the number of deaths at borders were quite low. If you look at the edges of the European Union, during the 1990s, there was on average less than 100 deaths per year of people trying to cross into the EU. The same thing at the U.S.-Mexico border. There were relatively few deaths per capita based on the number of people actually crossing the border. As these borders became hardened, as fences were built on the borders, as more agents were hired, as these military technologies were deployed to create security in these spaces, the idea with all of that was that it would deter people from trying to come, and that they would realize that it's hard to cross these borders, and so they would just decide not to make the trip. Mm. But that has proved to be a flawed idea. It didn't work. And so instead, the result has been that people still continue to try to come. Far more people are trying to go to Europe than were in the 1990s or even the early 2000s. But the result has been that there are a lot more deaths at borders. So at the edges of the EU, as a lot of people people, I think, are familiar with. There have been a substantial increase in the number of people dying trying to cross through the Mediterranean. It's the same thing at the U.S.-Mexico border. People have been funneled to more dangerous crossing routes. So instead of being able to cross from Tijuana to San Diego, they have to go through the deserts of Arizona, which involves a 50-kilometer trek through arid, dangerous terrain with no water available. And so it results in more deaths. So the conclusion that I come to is that the creation of the border itself and the patrolling of the border is directly causing these deaths at the border. That it was, in some ways, the intentional strategy of these border agencies to make it hard to cross the border with the assumption that more people are going to die in the process, but then the hope that that would discourage more people from trying to make the trip.
You also argue that the violence of borders today is really emblematic of a broader system that seeks to preserve privilege and opportunity for some by restricting access to resources of movement for others. So walls are not just markers of security and sovereignty of nation states.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, and it gets to a much longer argument that I make in the book, which is that there's a long history between people in positions of privilege, whether it's a ruler or today's states or wealthy corporations that have a lot of influence in states, and the poor, and that relationship has been based on restrictions on movement for a long period of time. So in the book, I link together an earlier history of things like slavery, serfdom, vagrancy laws, poor laws, which were all different mechanisms for containing the poor, locking them into a particular place through movement restrictions in order to access their labor at a low cost or often no cost in the form of slavery. So what I argue in the book, though, is that the mechanisms for controlling the movement of the poor have changed over the last 100, 200 years. That historically, those mechanisms for containing the poor and creating these pools of low-wage labor were often within a particular country. And so that the wealthy and the poor that they were containing were in the same place. Mm-hmm. What's happened over the last century is that there's a similar mechanism in place to control the movement of the poor, to protect resources and privileges and wealth that's accumulated in particular places, which is Europe and the United States predominantly, through the restrictions on movement of the poor. But increasingly that happens between countries rather than within particular countries.
But also it happens within the nation states, and a good example is what is happening in the U.S. They basically are taking the poor and they ghettoize them, or they put them in prison. They are visible and invisible structures for separating the poor from the privileged.
Absolutely. I'm definitely not suggesting that there is no more inequality within particular countries, and that these some sorts of mechanisms for containing the poor don't still exist. You can even think of things like gated communities as another example of this, right? Of a new system for bounding off a space for the privileged and excluding people from access to those spaces in order to protect the wealth and privileges that have accumulated. So there's no doubt about that. That's not the argument that they're not happening there. But instead, I am arguing that the new system that's emerged over the last 100 years of citizenship, of passports, of borders with immigration regulations on them, and then more recently, the emergence of border patrols and walls and security procedures at borders has created a similar system where the poor are often contained to particular places, which is their country of their birth, which creates a new form of pools of low-wage labor. And so today, corporations can very easily move across borders. They can set up factories wherever it's most advantageous for them, but the poor are contained to these countries, which creates these pools of low-wage labor, and they can't demand higher wages because there are so many people in a similar situation to them. A lot of people have in their mind that globalization is fundamentally about opening up borders, and it has for a number of things. So consumer goods cross borders as easily as they ever had. If you look at in all of our pockets, we have cell phones that were made all over the place. Pretty much every everything we buy in our daily lives was made somewhere quite distant from here. The wealthy also move very easily over borders, and that's part of a long history. The wealthy have always been able to travel quite freely. But over the last 30 years, there's also been a closing down of borders for the poor. So if you look at any of these trade agreements that are that have been signed in the past, like NAFTA, or the ones that are in discussion now, like the TPP, none of them include free movement for labor. So it's a crucial part of the current system that corporations and capital can move freely, whereas the poor and regulators as well cannot.
But these walls are spreading like wildfire. In 2015, Hungary, Austria, Slovenia, Macedonia, and Bulgaria all started construction or announced plans to build fences. In the last 2 months, Norway has begun construction of a steel fence at a remote Arctic border post with Russia. France, with British funding, is building a wall near the refugee camp in Calais. Saudi Arabia is planning to build a high-tech wall with two high fences, 300 feet apart, 40 watchtowers, 900 miles of fiber optic cable, underground movement detection. And of course, the most famous of all is the apartheid wall in Palestine.
Yeah, there are even some more that have happened this year that you didn't even mention, right? So some of the ones that you talked about, Bulgaria and Austria have expanded their walls, and Turkey also is building a quite large wall on the border with Syria, and also Pakistan started a fence on its Afghanistan border as well.
Jordan is building one as well.
Jordan as well, yeah. So it really is a dramatic uptick in the number of walls. In 1989, there were only 15 border walls around the world. Today, they're almost 70. So there's a really substantial increase, three quarters of them built in the last 20 years. I think there are a series of reasons for that. One is that there is an increasing awareness of people who are moving around and the desire to contain those movements. That was in place before. I think there was in the 1980s and 1990s a desire not to allow the poor to move, and the poor were trying to move during that period as well. But in the 1990s, there was a stigma associated with building a wall on a border. After the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the public narrative, at least in the U.S. and Europe, was that freedom had won and this exclusionary wall had come down. And so it would be very hard during that period to imagine that these democratic states would then build their own walls, right? It just simply wasn't something that they could legitimately do. After the war on terror narrative comes into place, it completely removes the stigma of things like building a wall and of expanding security procedures at borders, because it becomes something that states are almost obliged to do to protect their population from this, I would say some ways, imaginary fear of terrorists pouring into the country. And so it's after that. It's in the early 2000s that we see this dramatic increase in the number of walls. So the point that I'm making is that the underlying issue was there before, but that by the 2000s, that stigma of building the wall was removed, and suddenly it was okay to do it.
I'm talking with Rhys Jones, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and author of several books, including his most recent, Violent Borders: Refugees and the Right to Move. Let's talk about how walls and barriers have become sites of violence against refugees and migrant populations, with some specific examples. But first, I just want to run some stats by you. The refugee crisis that we are witnessing today is the worst since World War II. UNHCR stats are an unprecedented 65.3 million people around the world have been forced from their homes. Among them are nearly 21.3 million refugees, half of whom are under the age of 18. There are also 10 million stateless people who have been denied a nationality and access to basic rights such as education, health care, employment, and freedom of movement. Nearly 34,000 people are forcibly displaced every day as a result of conflict, persecution, poverty. These are astronomical figures. This worsening crisis has been getting attention because it landed on Europe's doorstep. But Europe is hosting only 6% of the refugees. And also, we have people who've been internally displaced. More than 10 million people, some 30% of the population of Iraq is displaced, and it's going to get worse. 6.6 million people, Syrians, are internally displaced. So how do you think we should begin to understand the consequences of this mass migration across borders and within borders of nation states, which has been characterized as a European refugee crisis?
The fact that it's called the European migration crisis, refugee crisis, is really problematic. I mean, as you mentioned, only, did you say 6% of the refugee population are actually in Europe? Just a few weeks ago, Amnesty International published a list of exactly where refugees are located. Out of the top 10 countries hosting refugees today in 2016, exactly zero of them are in Europe. So the top 10, Jordan has 2.7 million refugees, Turkey has 2.5 million, Pakistan has 1.6 million, Lebanon 1.5, Iran 979,000, Ethiopia 736,000, Kenya 533,000, Uganda 477,000, Democratic Republic of Congo 383,000, and Chad 369,000. So none of the countries hosting the most refugees are actually in Europe right now. I think it is a crisis that has to do with Europe, but I don't think it's a crisis that's really at Europe's doorstep right now. The point I would like to make is that the causes of a lot of these issues are Europe's problem. If you think about the history of colonization throughout Africa and the Middle East, there were decades and centuries in some places of European states extracting resources from places, disrupting the political system in those places, and then leaving behind newly independent countries that didn't necessarily have the economic system in place or the political system in place to succeed in a global economy that's emerged. And a second impact of European colonization are the borders that Europe left behind. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Africa, the states that exist for the most part are not based on the local cultural or political practices that existed before European colonization. Instead, they're for the most part are the borders of the European colonies that were agreed upon in the 1884 Berlin Conference and then just kept after that. So it's the imposition of European borders on many of these places that produces a lot of the conflict that we see today, because the borders don't match what was historically there and were imposed from the outside. Many people don't necessarily accept them. You see that for sure in the Middle East today, like the legacies of the Sykes-Picot agreement and a whole series of other European agreements about exactly where the borders should be, which states should be created, and that the leaders that were often put in place in these newly decolonized countries had favorable relationships with European states, which continued the dependent relationship. So instead of focusing on the well-being of the people, it was about maintaining those connections. And you see a number of countries serving in that same role today. Morocco is absolutely serving in that position at the moment. The European Union and Spain established an immigration agreement with Morocco in 2013 that provided some benefits to Morocco. It simplified student visas for Moroccan students to come to the European Union. But in exchange, Morocco agreed to assist the EU in preventing people from being able to pass through Morocco to get to Europe. And Morocco is particularly important for that because your listeners are probably better educated on this than many people. But there are two Spanish cities on the African continent, Melilla and Ceuta, which both have a population of about 80,000 people that are on Africa, so have a direct land border with Morocco. And so they have in some ways been a beacon for people on the move to try to reach those, because then they can set foot into the EU and then be part of this asylum process.
How did these two cities end up being part of Spain?
So when Spain reconquered the Iberian Peninsula from the Moors in the 1400s, they retook cities on the Iberian continent, so like Granada or Sevilla, but then they continued across to North Africa and retook several cities in North Africa, including Melilla and Ceuta, in order to have outposts there to continue to control the Moorish armies that were there, and so to prevent them from being able to cross the Strait of Gibraltar again to attack Spain. So Spain has had these two cities since the late 1400s on the North African coast. So Spain, of course, colonized northern Morocco in the 1800s, but when then they decolonized it in the 1900s, they claimed that these two cities didn't apply because they had had them for several hundred years, and so they've continued to maintain control of them. So Morocco continues to dispute this and wants to have those cities returned to Morocco, but it's a point of dispute between them. What these cities mean, though, is that there are these two places that are part of the EU, where EU asylum laws are in place, where the European Union exists in North Africa. And so in the 1980s and early 1990s, these were places where a lot of people would come that wanted to migrate to Europe would go to these first and then make their way to Europe.
Mostly from sub-Saharan.
Absolutely. So there's a geography to all of these movement flows. And so because of the location of Morocco, the majority of people making this route are going to be from Nigeria, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire, so that moving up that way, because that's where the migration networks are. So they would often go to Mali and then cross the Saharan Desert into Algeria and then make their way over to Morocco. And there's a whole network in place that moves people through that. So that's actually the first fences that the European Union built were at Melilla and Ceuta in 1993. So that gives hopefully your listeners a little bit of the historical scale of this process. It's not something that started in 2013 or 14 as it suddenly burst onto the news, but people have been on the move and have been crossing through these spaces for a long period of time. But we started this talking about Morocco signing this agreement with the European Union. And so at Melilla, for example, the European Union and Spain have three fences on the border, and people are not officially in the EU until they've crossed all three of those fences. But in 2015, with European Union money, Morocco started building a fourth fence. In Melilla, the fences are really quite close to each other, but there's space in between them. And so the idea is to slow people down from crossing, because the Spanish policy has been that if people only are able to cross the first or the second fence, then they have not officially set foot into the EU, and then they're returned back to Morocco. This is something that's still in dispute in European courts and Spanish courts, and it hasn't been finally adjudicated. But the current policy is that if someone crosses only the first or second fence, they can be returned to Morocco. If they cross the third, Spain is obligated to hear their asylum requests. But so to prevent them from even getting to those fences, Morocco has now built a fourth fence that's maybe 20 meters away, that's all barbed wire, and Morocco has positioned guards about every 100 meters along the border. Even more problematic for people on the move is Morocco also rounded up a lot of migrants. So there used to be a very large camp on a mountain beside Melilla where migrants would live there and then prepare to go all try to jump the fence together. They often go in groups of 100 or 200 people, so that if 10 or 15 people are able to get over all three, and the other 100 and so are caught. But Morocco cleared all of those camps in 2015 and bussed all of the people way to the southern end of Morocco to prevent them from actually being close to the edges of the EU.
Agence France-Presse reported that 100 young men from sub-Saharan Africa managed to get through a border system that you were talking about that is composed of 2 6-meter high fences with a crisscross of steel cables in between. In order to get across, migrants often use hooks and shoes studded with nails.
Yeah, to help them get over it. You'll often see, if you look it up online or in the media, images of literally dozens of people sitting up on top of these fences because they've been stopped by the Guardia Civil of Spain, and they're stuck up there waiting to find another opportunity. When I was in Morocco doing research, I did quite a bit of research in Morocco for this project.
And one of the things, last year?
Yes, 2015. And one of the things that I encountered in Morocco, so of course a lot of people are dying because of these walls and these security security procedures. But what I found also very heartbreaking was I encountered a lot of people on the move who were just stuck. For example, I met one family who was from Ghana, and they'd left Ghana in 2012 and had made it to Morocco in 2012. But since then, they've been stuck in Morocco. So they'd tried three times to go by boat to Europe, and the Moroccan Coast Guard had pushed them back. And so they were just living the life of essentially a permanent migrant, stuck on the streets of the Moroccan city of Nador, wandering around asking for food, asking for money. One thing I did notice in Morocco, at least, that the regular people living in Nador were quite friendly and nice to the people who were on the move. They didn't seem to have any problem with having this migrant population in their town. And while I was talking to this family, the little boy who was with them, they had two children. So, I mean, we're talking about a family. We're not talking about someone who is at all a threat to anyone. But the little four-year-old boy had wandered off, and he came back a few minutes later with a large strawberry that a Moroccan fruit vendor had given them. So the people on the move certainly experience kindness by a lot of people who help them along the way and have sympathy for their plight. But the governments often are not as friendly, and often the Moroccan government, particularly because of these agreements that they've signed, is put in a position where they have to do roundups for Spain and essentially enforce the border for Spain.
Even though there are not very many refugees in Morocco, something like 4,500 refugees are in Morocco?
Officially.
Officially,
yeah.
Of course. Officially, there are 4,500. But two-thirds of them are Syrians.
Right. So we definitely see that. So in 2015, the route that was getting a lot of the attention was the overland, was from Turkey to Greece, and then through the Balkans to Hungary, Austria, and then eventually trying to get to Germany to apply for asylum in Germany. And that's, of course, the one that has been heavily shut down. Hungary has built fences. Austria built fences. Macedonia has hardened their border, and so the people are stuck in Greece. Greece has built fences on the Turkey border, and now Turkey has built a wall on the Syrian border, right? So that route is, for the most part, closed down.
But people are still getting out.
People are still getting out, but nowhere near the numbers that were coming before. So you still see people going from Turkey to Greece and arriving in the islands in the Aegean, but in nowhere near the same numbers that we saw in 2015. A second part of that is the EU signed this agreement with Turkey as well, so that Turkey, in exchange for funds, is doing in some ways a similar thing to what Morocco is doing, is trying to prevent people from using Turkey as a transit space to get to the edges of the EU. And so there's no doubt that that is going to send people towards different routes to look for a way to cross into Europe.
Libya has also been a transit area for refugees and migrants coming from Africa and the Middle East.
At the current moment, my understanding is that there are not that many Syrian refugees going to Libya. Mm-hmm. Instead, the flows that we're seeing from Libya of people getting into boats and trying to make it to Italy are primarily people from sub-Saharan Africa, Eritrea as well. And a number of them actually had gone to Libya in the past 5 or 6 years before the war even there and were working in Libya, right? Because Libya has an oil industry and there were lots of jobs for people to work there. But that as Libya has collapsed and as there's not a central government in the same way, they find themselves to be in quite a bit of danger there. And so for them, often they can't get back to where they were from originally. And so their only option often is to get into a boat and try to make it to the EU.
Is it also because Tunisia, Egypt, they have also tightened their borders?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that you can see that quite clearly. A number of Syrians do fly to Algeria. So this is another route that I think has maybe slowed down a little bit as the Syrian war has become much more totalizing. But in the early years of the war, another route that people would take was to, then these are, of course, middle class, upper middle class people. Syria, of course, had a very well-educated population before this war that would take a flight from Syria to Algeria and then either go into Morocco or go into Libya in order to cross that way. But my understanding is the current groups coming from Libya are predominantly sub-Saharan African rather than Syrian.
That is Rhys Jones, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, speaking with Melihe about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Movement. We'll hear more after a break. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Example you give in your book is Australia, which has one of the most horrendous immigration and refugee policies. Amnesty International just came out with a report that accused Australian government of torturing refugees. For refugees and migrants who try to go to Australia, the trip begins in Jakarta, Indonesia. Iranians and Iraqi citizens don't need a visa to travel to Indonesia, and that leg of a trip is easy. But then they have to pay smugglers to take them to Australia. But immigrants who attempt the trip are often detained at sea before they reach Australia. Can you talk about this journey and where do these people end up?
Yeah, it's another route that has really been closed down in a lot of ways. My understanding is that not a single boat has reached Australia's mainland in 2015 or 2016. So they are heavily patrolling these waters, and it's very difficult to move through that area. So what they do, though, is after they locate these boats, which will be often leaving from Indonesia, trying to reach Christmas Island, which is a small island that Australia controls off the coast of Indonesia in the Indian Ocean. Once they're detained, they'll then be taken to a third-party country and put into a detention facility while their asylum requests are heard. And so right now, Australia has two of those camps. One is on...
So they are offshoring it.
They're offshoring it, right. So one of those camps is at Nauru, which is a small island state that has a population of less than 20,000 people, and it is... hosts this refugee resettlement facility for the Australian government. It's very difficult to know a lot of the details of what's happening at this camp because Nauru is an independent country and they deny visas to journalists. So journalists are not allowed to travel there. But there have been a number of reports that have come out over this summer about the conditions in these facilities. And there have been accusations of child abuse there and really just terrible conditions for the people living in those facilities. Two different people set themselves on fire at this facility in 2015 in hopes of raising attention to their plight, because the problem that they face at these facilities is that they're often there for what appears to be an indefinite period of time. So they are a number of people who are there, and it's a very large Iranian population, an Iraqi population, mm-hmm. and there are also a lot of Rohingya refugees who are fleeing Myanmar that are in these facilities. But they can be there for 2 to 3 to 4 years, and even if they are recognized as being a refugee after the adjudication process, Australia is not willing to take them themselves. And so instead, they're looking to sign agreements with other countries to take the refugees. So Australia has an agreement currently with Cambodia to accept people that have been judged to be refugees.
They're giving Cambodia $55 million, and they call it voluntary resettlement. Amnesty International came out with a report, as I said. It interviewed 62 refugees and asylum seekers in Nauru and more than a dozen current and former contract workers who delivered services on the behalf of the Australian government. The report is called Island of Despair. The evidence that they detailed shows allegations of recurrent self-harm, attempted suicide, children being hit by teachers and threatened with machete by peers, deficient medical care, and persecution akin to that which refugees had fled their homelands from. And this report tells the story of Iranians and Afghans they have attempted to kill themselves because they think it is better for them to be dead than to live in this camp.
Yeah.
And the government of Nauru says we're not taking any responsibility because Australia is really responsible for these camps. It is not in our jurisdiction.
Yeah, but then I think Australia also deflects in a very similar way to say that the camps are hosted in Nauru and that Nauru is providing the space for this and that it's their responsibility to ensure that the laws of Nauru are followed and that it's not actually Australian territory. So in some ways it creates this limbo where it's nobody's responsibility, which allows for these terrible conditions to be maintained in those camps. The other camp that Australia has is in Papua New Guinea at Manus Island, but the government of Papua New Guinea the Supreme Court has ruled that they have to close that camp down, that it violates the constitution of Papua New Guinea. So they're in the process of figuring out what to do with the people who are at that camp. But the Nauru camp, for now, seems to be kept in place. The thing that's most amazing to me about this is that you'll often hear people talk about the Australia solution to the refugee crisis, and people in government positions will talk about it as a successful option because it has prevented these ships from reaching Australia and Australia doesn't have to take on the refugees that go into these. And so despite the horrendous conditions in these camps and the, to me, quite clear human rights violations, you hear it proposed as a possible solution for Europe to look at.
So this is also another kind of wall that they have constructed, because the Italians have done the same thing in Lampedusa.
Mm-hmm.
They basically have moved the border into the sea.
Absolutely. So they patrol off the coast, right? And so it creates the equivalent of a border wall there because it's impenetrable. It prevents people from getting into that space and making it to that mainland. I should give Italy some credit, though, because I think Italy, in terms of the various countries in the Mediterranean that are dealing with this issue, they've been at the forefront of doing a better job of it. They have been, after some tragedies in 2013, they have been investing resources in trying to do rescues there.
This is when a boat with more than 365 people on it capsized.
Yeah, I think there were actually 500 people on the boat. 365 people died.
That's right.
And they were able to rescue about 100 people. So the policy before this tragedy in October of 2013, Italy's policy was that they wouldn't do any rescue of boats until they either received an SOS call or the boat reached shore. And so what was so shocking about this particular boat is that it was only a quarter mile off the coast. So it was literally there. It was right at the edge of Italy when this tragedy happened. So in the aftermath of that, Italy did put in place a policy where they would actively go out and look for boats and rescue people who were in those boats and bring them back to Italy. But that also proved to be extremely costly for Italy. They were using almost their entire navy for this and it was costing them $10 million a month to do that. So in late 2014, the EU took over this procedure. And so they have an operation working there. But they're not being as aggressive.
Frontex,
which is the European border agency, they're not being as aggressive as Italy was doing it before. And that's because there's a lot of dispute in the European Union about doing search and rescue. So, for example, the United Kingdom opposes any search and rescue in the Mediterranean because they argue that it's a pull factor and that if people on the move know that their boat is going to be rescued, they'll continue to come and to try to go to the EU. And so the UK's position is extremely problematic position that there should be no search and rescue so that more people die and that would prevent other people from trying to come, which is a failed idea because people continue to try to come. They're fleeing a situation that is terrible, right? I mean, if they're stepping on a boat and they don't know how to swim and they're going onto a crowded boat, obviously what they're fleeing is worse than this possibility that they're facing in the Mediterranean. So to me, the UK position completely misunderstands the motivations people have for being on the move.
So restriction of movement, as you detail in your book, the violent consequences of people trying to find safety in Europe and other countries, they have been well documented. So the plight of refugees has been well documented. The response to this crisis, on the other hand, has not been fully investigated. So Europe and other Western countries are trying to keep these refugees and migrants away by paying other countries to warehouse them. Many Eastern European countries are refusing to take in these refugees. Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have refused to host refugees. There are some 50,000 refugees stuck in Greece. There are many in the Balkan countries. Sweden and Germany, which were the final and are the final destinations for many of the refugees, are tightening their borders. So what is EU policy? Is it paying their former colonies and poor countries to take in and keep these refugees and eventually deport them back? So what is the formal policy of the European Union to deal with this issue?
So part of the issue with the European Union is that border control and asylum policies are not a European-wide issue. Instead, individual member countries continue to retain the right to control their borders and to set their own policies for asylum review and asylum procedures. And so that's why we see a lot of the problems happening in Europe today is that it doesn't have a unified policy. And so each individual country sets up their own rules, which is causing quite a bit of strife between the different parts of Europe about exactly how they should handle this crisis. One thing I would like to say is that in some ways the focus on refugees is also misleading from my point of view, because I believe that all humans have the right to move, and that when we focus only on refugees, that that's a very narrow category that's established by the state system. And the main purpose that it serves, while it does provide shelter and support for a small group of people who are in need, it also denies the right to move for the majority of people in the world who might want to look for better options elsewhere. So when we've been talking quite a bit about sub-Saharan migrants, and many people from sub-Saharan Africa would not qualify as a refugee based on the current system. So the current system of refugees is based on the UN Convention on Refugees, which defines a refugee as someone who's crossed a border and also as someone who's fleeing political persecution in their home country. And that can be based on beliefs, on religion, on race, or gender. So that means that someone fleeing a famine, for example, is not a refugee. Someone who's fleeing environmental change is not a refugee. Someone who is fleeing the lack of economic opportunities in their home country is not a refugee, based on the current definitions of it. So to me, we need to think about, there's short-term things we should be doing to solve this current refugee crisis, but there are also much longer questions we should be talking about who has a legitimate right to move.
UC Berkeley political scientist Wendy Brown argues that border walls and militarized security efforts are not a sign of a strength, but the last gasp of a dying political system based on territorially defined nation states. So she basically argues that it is the weakening of a state sovereignty, and more precisely, the detachment of sovereignty from the nation state. You say that when we see construction of these walls, it is not a sign that the nation state is crumbling, but it's hardening and it's fortifying itself.
Yeah, I'm friends with Professor Brown, and we actually have a journal article that we have coming out.
In a couple of weeks.
And she has revised her position a little bit on that. I think that she doesn't necessarily completely subscribe to the argument she made in that book at the time. Yeah, definitely from my point of view, the what we see at borders today is not the weakening of the state in any sort of way. Instead, our global system is fundamentally based on states right now. If you think about how the United Nations operates, you have to be a state to be a member of the United Nations. The way that various international agreements operate, they're agreements between states. And the way that this, what this migration issue has done, I think, has resulted in a number of people in a lot of countries reverting back to a much stronger nationalist view of who belongs in their place and who doesn't. And so I think that's why you see a lot of the, quite frankly, racist language that we see today in the United States, but also across Europe as well, and also the rise of a series of anti-migrant parties in many of these places. So I think that you could say the same thing for across Europe and the U.S. as well, that by bashing this, in some ways, imagined other that's racially different, that's culturally different, that's bringing possibly a different religion, and also is represented as being some sort of an economic threat, it gets people to kind of roused and excited for these nationalist ideas of our people first, right? I mean, you hear Donald Trump saying America first, and you can see it also in the Brexit decision, right? Mm-hmm. That it's kind of a reverting back to the idea of the nation state and turning away from things like a broader system like a European Union, or the idea that in some people's mind of globalization kind of starting to undermine the state. So I think that the last 10 to 15 years, the state has been reasserting itself. I would suggest it never really went away, and that that claims that it was playing a lesser role misunderstood the role that the state plays as the fundamental political and economic unit in the world today. But I think you can clearly see today that it is having a bit of a resurgence. I would argue quite clearly that the walls are a symbol of this, of the expansion of the state to control another part of its territory and another flow between different states in a way that it wasn't able to in the past.
However, you end your book on a positive note. You say, despite the death at borders and the violence of the state, millions more people continue to move. These migrants' decisions are what Simon Springer terms revolution of the everyday. By refusing to abide by a wall, map, property line, border, identity document, or legal regime, mobile people upset the state's schemes of exclusion, control, and violence. They do this simply by moving.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, In Violent Borders, a lot of it is saying the bad things that are happening. But I think that the fact that people continue to move and don't abide by these restrictions, it's bringing those restrictions into question. And so if people continue to do that, it opens up more space for people like me and you to discuss what other worlds might look like and what it might mean to have a world where there is freedom of movement and where we respect movement as a fundamental human right. And I think the fact that so many people are on the move today, and many people doing that on foot. If you think of the Syrian refugees who went out to march in Hungary and just decided, we're not going to be stuck here, we're going to march en masse to the German border, and we're going to move regardless of what you say, I think it evokes a lot of past marches that became powerful symbols as a way to resist poverty. If you think of marches in the U.S. South against the segregation system, but also in India, there was the Salt March that Gandhi led, where people marched to the sea to gather salt to protest British occupation in India. That fact that people use movement to resist the imposition on power, I think, is a very effective way to demonstrate how movement restrictions can be upset.
Rhys Jones is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and author of several books, including his most recent, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Movement. He spoke with Melih Razazan from Pacifica Radio. This is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Thank you. that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. How does the melting Arctic affect the rest of the world? NOAA's Arctic Report Card, 2016. The Arctic is now warming twice as fast as the global average. That's the finding in the 11th Arctic Report Card, released on December 13, 2016, at the annual American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco. The area around the North Pole is now 3.5 degrees Celsius warmer than in 1900, way above the safety goals set at the 2015 COP21 conference. In Paris, an agreement was made to keep warming under 1 to 1.5 degrees Celsius to prevent dangerous climate change. NOAA's Arctic Research Program Director Jeremy Mathis said about the year 2016, "Rarely have we seen the Arctic show a clearer, stronger, or more pronounced signal of persistent warming than this year." The Arctic Report Card lists the many ways in which the warming Arctic affects sea level rise, ocean and air circulation, as well as weather in the Northern Hemisphere and beyond. Until recently, humankind knew very little about the Arctic, the near-permanent ice that filled the North Pole region between the coastlines of Russia, Norway, Iceland, Greenland, Canada, and the U.S., concealed the fact that all this is ocean. Research from satellites, submarines, and icebreakers revealed a melting trend during the Arctic summer that has been accelerating since 1988. Scientists are now offering estimates for the complete disappearance of sea ice during the Arctic summer that range from 2020 to 2040. Ice does reform during the Arctic winter, but no longer grows fast and thick or completely fills the area up to the coastlines. In turn, the warming Arctic oceans also lead to melting of permafrost on land and affect the Greenland ice sheet. A surprise for scientists was that a warming Arctic also changes the ocean currents in the Northern Hemisphere, and even the wind currents. The jet stream that blows from west to east around the Arctic follows the boundaries between hot and cold air. As the Arctic warms, the temperature difference diminishes and the jet stream slows and begins to meander further to the north and south. The unseasonable coldness or warmth we experience in areas of North America is one result. NOAA is a scientific agency within the United States Department of Commerce, and you will discover a few curious references to potential benefits of Arctic warming for shipping and tourism in this press conference. They relate to the commercial mission of an agency that also does excellent science. The American Geophysical Union, AGU, is an organization of geophysicists from 144 countries. Geophysical sciences involve atmospheric and ocean sciences, as well as Earth and space. At the AGU on December 13, 2016, there was standing room only for the press conference that was about to reveal the peer-reviewed assessment of the Arctic Report Card for 2016. NOAA Arctic Research Program Director Jeremy Mathis presented, alongside Don Perovich, Adjunct Professor of Engineering at Thayer School of Engineering, lead editor for the Sea Ice Essay, and Marco Tedesco. He's professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, Columbia University, and the lead editor for the Greenland Ice Essay. Here's Professor Jeremy Mathis.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to see you all here, that we have a standing room only crowd for the Arctic Report Card this year. NOAA and our partner scientists from around the world have been tracking the Arctic and putting out the annual peer-reviewed Arctic Report Card for the last 11 years. And I'm really proud to say that this year, the Arctic Report Card represents the work of 61 scientists from 11 different countries. And that's really important this year because we've seen a year in 2016 in the Arctic like we've never seen before. The report card this year clearly shows a stronger and more pronounced signal of persistent warming than in any previous year in our observational record. And those warming effects in the Arctic have had a cascading effect through the environment, including down into Arctic ecosystems. And while the science of what's driving that change gets clearer, we need to expand and improve our ability to do sustained observations in the Arctic. And we need to do these sustained observations to help provide actionable information and intelligence for forecasting that people desperately need in the Arctic, as well as other stakeholders who are looking to take advantage of emerging opportunities in the Arctic. The issues that we're facing today in the Arctic include food security, cultural survival, environmental and community health, as well as extensive development opportunities. And these opportunities are related to commerce and trade, and as well as national security. So with that, we're going to take you through a summary of the Arctic Report Card this morning. There are a great many more details in the report itself, so I encourage you to look into it carefully and read the nuances in the chapters. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Don Perovich, who's going to take us through the first part of the report card.
Arctic air temperature continues to increase at double the rate of the average global temperature. Since the beginning of the 20th century, Arctic-wide annual average air temperature over land has increased by 3.5 degrees Celsius. That's 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit. Between October 2015 and September 2016, this air temperature was 2 degrees centigrade, or 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, above the 1981 to 2010 baseline. This marks the highest value in the observational record, a record that began in 1900. Autumn, spring, and winter showed extensive warm air temperature anomalies across the entire central Arctic. This was primarily due to southerly winds moving warm air into the Arctic from mid-latitudes. However, there are also cold temperature anomalies across the central Arctic Ocean in the summer of 2016. And these air temperatures influence the sea ice cover of the Arctic Ocean. After experiencing the lowest winter maximum sea ice extent in the satellite record, a satellite record that began in 1979, many anticipated a record summer minimum extent. But relatively cold summer air temperatures over the Arctic Ocean prevented that. However, due to extreme warming this fall, the report card editors decided to add an addendum to update several indicators, including sea ice. Warm air and ocean temperatures in the fall led to a record-breaking delay of fall freeze-up in the Arctic sea ice. From mid-October to the present, the ice extent has been the lowest observed since the beginning of the satellite record. Again, a record that began in 1979. As the sea ice retreats in the summer, previously ice-covered water is exposed to more sunlight. Unlike the white surfaces, which reflect sunlight, the dark ocean absorbs the sun's heat. This is causing sea surface temperature to increase throughout much of the Arctic Ocean and adjacent seas. Relatively warm regional air temperatures and warmer water from the North Atlantic and Pacific Oceans are also contributing to these warmer upper ocean temperatures. In fact, in August 2016, sea surface temperature was up to 5 degrees centigrade. That's 9 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the 1982 to 2010 average. This was in regions of the Barents and Chukchi Seas and off the east and west coast of Greenland. Ocean primary productivity, or algae blooms, are also increasing as the summer sea ice declines. Increased algae blooms are observed throughout the Arctic Ocean and adjacent seas, particularly in the Barents Sea and in Canada's Hudson Bay, where primary productivity was 19% above the 2003 to 2015 baseline. These conditions in the Arctic Ocean make it more prone to ocean acidification. This is compared to the rest of the global oceans because ocean acidification is caused by the uptake of increased human-caused carbon dioxide emissions. The Arctic Ocean absorbs more carbon dioxide because it is relatively cool and experiences a relatively high influx of fresh water from melting glaciers and sea ice. Marine calcifiers like clams and snails, which build shells, are particularly vulnerable. Over the next 2 to 3 decades, ocean stress on Arctic-based marine fisheries and the Arctic communities that depend on these fish for food, culture, and livelihood. Now, to shift to more of the report card, I'll turn things over to Marco.
Thank you, Don. And let's start with the Greenland ice sheet. The Greenland ice sheet continued to lose mass in 2016, as it's done since 2002, when satellite measurements are available. The melt onset in 2016 was the second earliest in the 37 record of observations from satellites, close to the record of the 2012 by a few days. The melting season lasted up to 30 to 40 days longer than usual in the northeast Greenland and 15 to 20 days longer along the west coast compared to the 1981-2010 average. Shifting to spring snow cover, the snow cover extent has also declined over the period of satellite observations starting in 1967 and particularly since 2005. In 2016, a new record low of April and May snow cover extent was reached in North America. Warming Arctic surface air temperatures have a clear influence on the timing of snow melt onset. However, there's also evidence that snow depth is decreasing, and which might precondition also snowpack for earlier and more rapid melt in the springtime. Following to 3-4 years of decline of browning, tundra greenness, a saline measure of chlorophyll, generally increased throughout the Arctic between 2014 and 15. Longer-term trends show a mix of greening and browning varying on a regional basis. Warming air temperatures in the Arctic are causing normal frozen ground called permafrost to thaw. The permafrost is carbon-rich, and when it thaws, it gives off greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide and methane. Tundra ecosystems are taking up increasingly more and more of this carbon during the growing season over the past several decades, but this has been also offset by increasing carbon loss during the winter. And overall, we estimate the tundra is actually releasing net carbon to the atmosphere. And now I'm going to give the word to Jeremy again. Thank you.
So as I said, that was just a very brief overview of what's in the report card and a high-level summary that we wanted to provide this morning to facilitate the questions that we want to be able to take from you. And so before we go into the question phase, I just want to summarize that the impacts of the persistent warming trend over the last 30 years in the Arctic are clearly evident in the land and the ocean environment. And the acceleration of many of these signals, their interdependency, and the growing recognition that the Arctic is an integral part of the larger Earth system have increased the pressure for more effective and timely communications of data to our relevant communities. And as we've started saying more and more, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. We look to meet these challenges by better synthesizing Arctic change across disciplinary boundaries and taking a holistic approach as we think about Arctic science. And as we move forward with products like the Arctic Report Card, we're going to be thinking about ways to use it as a tool that can not only present our scientific findings and summaries of the science that has occurred during the year, but also begin to think about strategies and adaptation solutions that can be applied for communities in the Arctic and for people around the world as we deal with the consequences of Arctic change.
We've been doing the report card for 11 years, and when it started, you kind of had to listen closely because the Arctic was whispering change, and now it's not whispering anymore. It's speaking change, it's shouting change.
That was Don Perovich, adjunct professor of engineering at Dartmouth College. During the Q&A session, a journalist asked about the economic consequences of the rapidly warming Arctic. Here's Marco Tedesco, research professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory.
If you think about it, in North America, when the snow melts, how much snow you have, how fast will disappear, it's impacting a lot of activities in terms of hydropower production, for example, freshwater resources, but also it's impacting the ecosystems around it. You know, the snow melting sooner and faster is leaving a drier soil exposed to a warmer summer. So you might have more droughts, you might have more forest fires. So this might have, of course, ramifications for economy, for population. Permafrost thaw, of course, has a big impact on infrastructure in Alaska and other places where it was considered to be permanently frozen, and now it's not anymore.
It's a common question, when will the Arctic be ice-free in summer? And it's important to remember in summer, there'll still be ice in the winter. There's a lot of speculation. If you look at model projections, around 2040. But again, that's just an estimate of an unknown future. Another interesting question to pose is, when will the reduction of sea ice be so large that it impacts human activities? And I like that question because that's one I can answer. And that's right now. We've seen it in increased resource exploration. We saw it this past summer with the cruise ship, the Crystal Serenity, navigating the Northwest Passage that more than a century ago, no one could get through at all. So I think we're seeing changes in the sea ice cover now that are impacting human activities, and it's a particularly difficult time because the ice is in transition, and transitions are always particularly difficult to predict. In terms of the sea ice cover, I mean, we talk a lot about changing from 8 million square kilometers to 3 million square kilometers, and those are big numbers. But if you look at it, back in the 1980s, the September ice extent was around the size of the continental United States. If we look at this past year, 2016, it's as though part of the United States has melted. The entire United States east of the Mississippi, plus the states from Minnesota all the way down to Louisiana, plus all of North Dakota. So the changes are significant. The changes are real. We put these changes out there so people are aware of what's going on.
And also, of course, the Arctic Report Card is based on observations. It's evidence-based on the observations. The data is paid by the public, by the U.S. public, through the federal government, and it's publicly available. It's transparent, and I think it speaks for itself.
If we left this room and looked from space at the Arctic sea ice cover, it's bright and it's white. It reflects most of the sunlight, reflects 80% of the sunlight incident on it. But when that melts away and you have an ocean, it goes from being a good reflector of sunlight to a really good absorber of sunlight. It absorbs over 90% of the sunlight, and that causes warming, which causes more melting, which causes more warming, and you get a feedback. And that's called the ice albedo feedback. But it's a way that you can take a small change and amplify it into a big change. In terms of the impact on marine ecosystems, there's a couple things going on that also, even before the ice melts away, it thins. In a simple sense, for phytoplankton, they need nutrients and they need light. And as the ice melts, they're getting more light, so you get these big blooms. And the question is the rest of the food web ready to interact with these blooms when and where they happen. And that's something that we just don't know at this time.
And Don, if I may add something also there, if you expose the ocean, you're changing completely also the way the surface interacts with the atmosphere, because exposing the ocean releases more moisture in the atmosphere, which in turn means energy and can be used for melting even more. We see these connections for Greenland, for example, between the sea ice disappearance and Greenland, and we see other connections about cloud formations and other things that might impact the atmosphere around the Arctic.
And I will add one thing. I can't sit up here and not say ocean acidification one time, for those of you who know me. So, the greening that's happening in the Arctic, this increase in primary productivity, is stimulating phytoplankton growth, which may have positive effects on the Arctic ecosystem. It may provide more food into the base of the food web. But at the same time, that primary productivity is the mechanism by which carbon dioxide is moved from the atmosphere into the ocean. And that's what ocean acidification is. It's the movement of carbon from the air into the water. So we already see a rapid progression of ocean acidification in the Arctic, and that seems to be accelerating as the ice melts back further and further and productivity increases. So on the one hand, we're going to be having more phytoplankton and providing more food into the food web, but on the other hand, it's going to be an exacerbation of the ocean acidification effect. So that's another process that we're going to have to pay very close attention to see what the balance is between ecosystem productivity and impacts associated with ocean acidification.
Are there any other questions from reporters in the room?
I understand that the Arctic and the Antarctic are very different environments, but I think sometimes it gets confusing as to why there's ice growth in Antarctica and then these annual report cards from the Arctic showing such dramatic change. So can you explain why looking at the Arctic is not just cherry-picking a very dramatic region?
I would say if it's raining in Italy, would you think that the same thing has to happen in the West Coast of the United States? I mean, they are completely different systems. What joins them together is the fact that they are covered by ice. But the atmosphere, the ice, the size of the continent, the size of the ice, and how they react to the input from the atmospheric change in terms of system is completely different. Greenland, the Arctic, is an ocean surrounded by land. Antarctica is this piece of ice surrounded by ocean. The winds somehow, circumpolar winds, are protecting Antarctica somehow from spills of what mid-latitudes activities going on in terms of the atmosphere. Ozone hole, believe it or not, is responsible for some of the strengthening or weakening of these circumpolar winds. And they are very two different systems. So I understand there might be some confusion, but this sounds to me like the postcard I saw once when somebody says, greetings from the Arctic, and it was a polar bear and a penguin. So this confusion should not happen, I think.
Hi, Santa Barbara Independent. From your remarks about the trends, it sounded like this fall in the Arctic might have been a little bit of a surprise. If so, can you talk about that, Mr. Perovich?
It was a record, and records are always, you know, somewhat surprising. When I look at things, for me, the biggest surprise was in 2007. The Arctic sea ice summer extent reached an all-time record minimum by a record amount. And if you look at the time series of ice extent, it's never gone higher than it was in 2006. So it's as though we were in one state slowly declining, and then there was this sharp drop to a new normal that we've continued to bounce around. Some years are a little up. 2012 was another record minimum, but it's just there was this major change in 2007. And for me, that was a big surprise. I think it is interesting to see what's going to happen this year with the fact that fall freeze-up is so slow and the air temperatures are so warm, but it's still early in the year.
And for me, the surprise this year has been we've shifted a little bit. The stories have been about the summertime, summer minimum, summer temperature excursions, summer snow cover. And now we're seeing the persistent warming carrying over into the winter months. So we don't know enough yet. We need a few more years to see if that trend continues or if it has been a one-off thing related to some larger global process. But if the persistent warming that we've seen this fall carries over for the next few years, then as Don just said, we may be at another step in a regime shift in the Arctic that will lead to a new era of change, even compared to what we're seeing now.
And as we pointed out, so for Greenland, it's just not lasting longer. It's also starting earlier. We suffer the snow over the United States. So the melting season is also stretched, somehow getting longer, invading somehow spring and fall. And this is creating preconditioning before the current melt, but also is preconditioning potentially the next melting season.
I think we have time for one last question.
My name is Mary Miller from the Exploratorium. You mentioned what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay there. Can you give us some examples of how, for instance, that extremely warm fall has potentially affected weather patterns, in other parts of the world, maybe us down here?
Do you want to take that, Marco?
I think there are people in the audience who can somehow link to this, and I'm asking them if they feel comfortable to speak. But in the case of, for the atmospheric point of view, and jet stream, and I just don't want to put Jennifer on the spot, but Jennifer Francis, she's here. But for Greenland, in any case, where we talk about albedo, remember that also we're talking about large-scale phenomena. If the solar radiation is absorbed more by the ocean, there's less in the atmosphere. The gradient, the difference between the temperature at the pole and the mean latitude is one of the drivers of climate on Earth, and that is changing. And that is impacting weather patterns and climate. But Jennifer she's willing to say something, but I'll be more than happy to do so.
Sure. Jennifer Francis at Rutgers University. Thanks, Marco. It's difficult to unravel how current or extreme weather that we've seen this fall, and there has been plenty of that, might have a role of the Arctic in it. I mean, that will be topics of research for sure. But that said, seeing an Arctic that's so much warmer than it should be all this fall by such huge margins, I can't imagine that there isn't going to be an impact on the weather that we've seen this fall. Over the last few years, we've noticed that when we have these big pulses of warmth in the Arctic, they are always associated with extreme weather events. And again, it's hard to make absolute definite connections between those two things, but we definitely see these causal relationships. And as Marco said, when the Arctic gets so warm and reduces this north to south temperature difference, we know that tends to have a slowing effect on the west to east winds of the jet stream. It tends to take these bigger north-south swings, and that all by itself is contributing to the warming of the Arctic. So it's helping to bring that warm air and moisture poleward, which is exacerbating the warming, which is maybe causing the jet stream to be even wavier. So we may be seeing this new feedback emerging between the warming Arctic and what's happening with the jet stream.
Thank you. We are out of time. That concludes our press conference. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Jennifer Francis from Rutgers University. She was part of the team of 61 scientists from 11 nations that presented the 11th annual peer-reviewed report card on the status of the Arctic under the auspices of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The other speakers were Marco Tedesco, he's professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, Columbia University, New York, and NOAA's Arctic Research Program Director, Jeremy Mathis, and Don Perovich, Adjunct Professor of Engineering at Dartmouth College. The report provided the latest information on the accelerating warming of the Arctic. The Arctic Report Card 2016 has been posted free online from the beginning. We need to make sure that this research will not be defunded or classified. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
As a Klansman dipped in dumb, misguided zeal, Mr. Trump. You're a rotten orange with alarmingly fascist ideas. You're a monster, Mr. Trump. You say Muslims are uncontrolled. Claim they cheered on 9/11. Now you want to ban them all, Donald Trump. I wouldn't touch you despite your 39.5% lead in the polls. You hate Mexicans, Mr. Trump. Say Latinos steal and rape. You want to build a wall and make Hispanics pay it all, Mr. Trump. Given the choice between you and Ben Carson, I'd choose...
Do I have to pick? They're both awful. I don't want to support either, even as a joke. In fact, this song is just going to draw more attention to Trump. Big picture, people, are we doing more harm than...
A nightmare, Mr. Trump. You're a callous sexist stooge, mocking disabled reporters, calling women ugly too, Donald Trump. The three words that best describe your lack of political experience are as follows, and I quote,
huge, huge, huge.
You're a mean one, Mr. Trump. This campaign you have derailed. You're an electoral fungus topped with cotton candy hair, Mr. Trump.
Your candidacy is an appalling dump heap overflowing with the most disgraceful assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable. And you probably disapprove of this song because it's about Christmas, but it's not religious enough, even though you don't really care. Jesus f***ing Christ!
A seasick crocodile.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in radical history for the week of December 29th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Some audio is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. And other radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for December 29th, 1890, Wounded Knee Massacre. At Pine Ridge, South Dakota, 300 mostly unarmed Indians killed when the 7th Cavalry discharges artillery amongst women, children, and fleeing men. 18 soldiers would get the Congressional Medal of Honor for their bravery. In 1974, Ayn Rand, neocon poster child, was asked at West Point to reconcile her view of America with, among other things, the culture genocide of Native Americans. Her quote was, "Any white person who brought the element of civilization had the right to take over this continent." This week in Radical History for December 30th, workers remembering workers' history. Businessman Frank Stoltenberg, who had become governor of Idaho on the Populist Party, who ticketed then proceeded to call in federal troops to crush the 1899 miners' strike, is blown to pieces at a bomb attached to his front gate. On this date in 1936, GM workers' sit-down strike, which began 2 days ago in Cleveland, Ohio, spreads to Flint, Michigan. This was the last sit-down strike in the United States since the Chicago sit-down strike of last week, where workers took over a window manufacturing plant and successfully occupied the building until the demands were met. In 1961, the international edition of the New York Times runs an announcement by Civil Defense Letter Committee regarding fallout shelters.
Condition wrecked. May God have pity on you.
This is Conrad. This is not a practice, not a drill.
Take cover! Take cover! Take cover! It's a red alert, condition red. Turn off the gas.
Why?
Why? It's condition red. It isn't practice. It's the bomb. The bomb is coming.
Oh, my God. No.
Turn off the gas anyway. I'm going to...
Also on this date in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, indicted by federal grand jury for releasing Pentagon Papers to the news media. The Pentagon Papers proved once and for all the basis for going to Vietnam was based on a lie perpetrated by the United States government, and the Gulf of Tompkins situation never really occurred. 40 years later, we did not learn our lesson. Hence, we're in Iraq. Also on this date in 1972, Tricky Dick Nixon finally orders the end of bombing. During the 12 days of the Christmas bombing in Vietnam, the U.S. by its own account lost 15 B-52s, 11 fighter bombers, with 93 people killed or missing. Hanoi claims 76 planes are shot down. Nixon, elected on the campaign lie that he had a secret plan to end the war, he had none whatsoever, made a last attempt to get North Vietnam to submit to U.S. hegemony. This final push was 18 days of carpet bombing of homes, hospitals, and civilians in Hanoi and Haiping through Christmas. It is also worth of some note that is the first time in history that some B-52 bomber pilots refused to fly these missions. This week in Radical History for December 31st. 1775, America attacked the city of Quebec is launched during a blinding snowstorm. One of the two American generals is killed. The second is wounded during the opening encounter. The attack fails as the Canadians have killed or wounded half the American troops. Also on a state in 1901, the worst year in the 20th century for lynching in the United States ends with a total of 105 blacks and 25 whites lynched that we know of. Also on a state in 1918, Dr. Marie Ikoy is found guilty of sedition, as were countless others opposing American involvement in one of Europe's bloodiest wars, under the newly amended Espionage Act. This law forbade criticism of the United States government, the Constitution, the military, the flag, navy, or uniform. Some Wisconsin news, 1969, a twin-engine Cessna takes off from the airport outside Madison, Wisconsin, flies 35 miles north, drops 3 bombs on the Badger Army Munitions Plant. An unidentified person calls the Daily Cardinal and identifies the bombers as members of, quote, the vanguard of the revolution. The Cessna was stolen by Dwight and Carl Armstrong. They had an uncle who died in the plant in 1945 by accidental explosion and were anti-Vietnam War activists, and felt they needed to bring the war home. The 3 bombs turned out to be nothing more than mason jars filled with gasoline and didn't hit anything. However, they felt it important to do a symbolic gesture. In 1970, Congress repeals the Gulf of Tompkins Resolution, and Congress finally fesses up that the United States had lied about the Tompkins affair.
This is your Radio Root supporter, Hannah George. Today is the beginning of a new year, on some calendars at least, and it seems to be a very revolutionary day. On this day, January 1st in 1804, Haiti gains independence from French rule, becoming the first independent country in the West Indies. In 1959, the Cuban Revolution succeeded in overthrowing Fulgencio Batista, former president of Cuba. In 1960, the Republic of Cameroon achieved independence from France and the UK. In 1981, the Republic of Palau, just east of the Philippines, fought for a self-government, though it was still not completely independent from the United States. In 1984, the Sultanate of Brunei in Southeast Asia became independent of the UK. And in 1994, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation initiated 12 days of armed conflict in the Mexican state of Chiapas. Viva Zapata! Get inspired, folks! Start your own revolution! Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say it.
Also this week in Radical History, for January 1st, 1804, Haitian slaves declare independence, and Haiti becomes the first black nation state in the world. The U.S. refuses to recognize Haiti for the next 70 years. Also on January 1st, 1863, kids try to remember this, President Abraham Lincoln frees the slaves. However, you should remember what he said in 1858, quote, "I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about any way the social political equality of the white and black races. I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. I am as much as any man in favor of having a superior position assigned to the white race." Abraham Lincoln, 1858. Also on this date in 1932, the year begins with a deep sense of foreboding and fear as the American economy begins to grind to a standstill. National income has declined by 50%. Breadlines now include former shopkeepers, businessmen, middle-class housewives. Charity is overwhelmed. Only one-fourth American unemployed is receiving any kind of help at all. Hubert Hoover starts an advertising campaign by his unemployment relief organization to promote private and local charities to help ease the problems with economic depression. As public money for relief runs out, many rich Americans oppose increased taxes to help out. More commonly, evade those taxes they are supposed to pay. For example, J.P. Morgan pays no taxes at all this year. In 2008, Goldman Sachs executives get a bailout of $10 billion. Just 3 days ago, Goldman Sachs pays out $10.93 billion to their executives as bonuses. Same plight, different years. Also in the state, 1960, the Man in Black, ex-convict Johnny Cash, plays in San Quentin, the first of many concerts he'll perform for prison inmates.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row, a crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their fields, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup. Those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth. And I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting in its way, he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold, the ark of his testament is stowed, a throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire. And God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb. My head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter the bright eye, I go shuffling out of life just to hide in death a while. And anyway, I never lie. And the mercy seat is waiting. And I think my head is burning. And in a way, I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth. And I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is burning. And I think my head is glowing. And in a way I'm hoping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway there was no proof. And I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is glowing. And I think my head is smoking. And in a way I'm hoping to be done with all these looks of disbelief. A life for a life and a truth for a truth. And I've got nothing left to lose. And I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is smoking. And I think my head is melting. And in a way that's helping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway, I told the truth. But I'm afraid I told a lie.
Reporter Navi Santu. On this day, January 2nd, in 1920, the Palmer Raids were at their peak in America. The Palmer Raids were a series of controversial raids by the U.S. Justice and Immigration Departments that lasted from 1918 to 1921. The raids, which were a direct attack on the Communist Party and the radical left in the U.S., involved illegal means of gaining information, illegal searches and seizures, mass arrests, deportation, and torture. J. Edgar Hoover, the chief of the Justice Department's Radical Division, actually organized the raids. No wonder he went on to a 48-year career as director of the FBI, the perfect candidate. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
People, the time's
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, January 3rd in 1961, the U.S. officially severed diplomatic relations with Cuba, an event that had been approaching since the Cuban Revolution 2 years earlier. Back in the 1800s, American corporations began to search for new markets and investments abroad. Cuba was one of the countries recognized as a capitalist gold mine and was eventually transformed into one at the expense of Cuba's own economy. In 1959, when Fidel Castro reclaimed full control over the Cuban government and economy, he began to openly speak out against America's exploitation of the country and its people. The U.S. was enraged by this new regime, and the conflict became clear. In order for the revolution to carry out the radical reforms it had been promising since 1953, the business interests of the U.S. had to be disregarded, and a clash was inevitable. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Years of boredom for trying to change the system from within.
I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
This has been This Week in Radical History for December 29th.
Say to people who are thinking about coming but out here to help, but they're on the fence about it.
Tell them to come. Fight your warrior spirit and get here.
In four corners, four directions, four colors, and death rides on four horsemen. A black snake with some black tank. How much money do these companies need to make? They could drop their product, but they wanna save a buck. Already extracted billions, when is enough enough? I used to be in the oil fields, getting paid, but I quit, cause oil water I can't drink. Look down and see Kamimi La die in the mud. I looked up and told myself that enough's enough. Money does not own my soul, living comfortable. It's not in my plans, my hands in the sand. Some things worth more than gold. Some things they can't be sold. Some things can't be replaced. She's your mother, the fresh water is her veins. Going on, have we all lost our minds? Every human needs clean water to survive.
We're sorry, your call cannot be called.
Another profound insight I had on this trip is that the earth is our mother. And Brian, that was something I knew intellectually. It was some hippie concept I'd been exposed to many times. Oh man, the earth is your mother, man, you know. Mm. But the earth is our mother. It is literally, the earth is our mother, and we are absolutely destroying her. She asks for nothing from us, and we are just abusing and wrecking her. And that was became so clear to me, and I understand that so much now.
Will that change the way you do
things?
Yes,
it will definitely change the way I do things a lot.
Love is the strongest, this path is the hardest. But if we weren't strong enough to do it, we wouldn't see it. Our prayers would not be needed, this movement's very needed. Indigenous wisdom unheeded and sacred things depleted. I'm Mexicano, Malacota, and I'm white too. I'm mixed with everyone, so part of me's just like you. Every group of human beings shares the same stars. And if the earth is not your mother, are you from Mars? Since 1492, 500 years and counting. Surviving the genocide they call colonizing my turtle island. What is the fossil fuel? Continued destruction, nothing new. Living a system, taking our children, shipping their feelings till nothing's true. I had that money in front of me, but I left it. Cause oil money's dirty if my mother gets disrespected. We're disconnected, these times are hectic and feeling heavy. But still we love all living beings and suffer for the many. We are peaceful people, that's why we walk with prayer. And if that wasn't true, we wouldn't be standing here. We're peaceful people, we walk with prayer. Turtle Island, have no fear. Despite what they show in the media, we're kind people, hold your ground. Change is coming now.
And we don't have to compete with anyone anymore because a rising tide raises all ships, right? I mean, this is, it's not about me, it's about everybody.
And ships minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs. All I ever have, redemption songs. Songs of freedom, songs of freedom.